Good Tuesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you once again from beautiful Farmville, Virginia today, where it is sunny, about 80 degrees. It is absolutely beautiful. We get it for about 36 more hours, and then it goes back up to like 90 degrees with 90% humidity. So I'm in a particularly good mood today, and we've got a great show for you. Chuck Michelle going to join us a little bit later on in the hour. Chuck, one of the attorneys working on the Peruta case for years and years. Yesterday, I'm sure, not completely unexpected news for Chuck, but still, we'll talk with Chuck, find out what it's like to hear the Supreme Court say, sorry, we're not going to take your case, and have a couple of justices say, but we really should take this case. And we'll find out what is next, because there is the Peruta 2 case, which has already been filed. And in addition to that, there is another lawsuit involving a California law that is set to go into effect on July the 1st. This is the state's ban on the possession of magazines over 10 rounds. So it doesn't matter how long you've owned these magazines. The state of California has said you may no longer own them legally. Now, they're not going to give you any money for it. And you can turn them in to the government. You can take them out of state, but you cannot legally possess these magazines. Again, lawsuit filed, and we could be hearing whether or not an injunction is going to be granted in this case before that ban takes effect. And who knows how many hundreds of thousands of California gun owners are turned into criminals overnight. But we'll talk with Chuck Michelle about that as well. It's not one thing, it's another there in California. Later in the hour, actually, before we move on from Peruta, also coming up in hour three, Guy Relford, Second Amendment attorney out in Indiana, going to join us to talk about the Peruta case. Later this hour, Kelsey Harkness joins us from the Daily Signal, but her latest article in the Federalist, Nasty Women Targeting Problematic Women, We're Not Going Anywhere. She says, yeah, apparently Elle Magazine had this article about how do we deal with problematic women. The problematic women in question, there was a graphic accompanying this article. I believe it was Kellyanne Conway. Maybe Laura Ingraham, or maybe it was Ann Coulter. But apparently some women are deemed to be problematic. Kelsey thinks that maybe she falls under that rubric, knows a lot of other women who, Elle might consider problematic. And again, Kelsey says they're not going anywhere. Next hour, Cheryl Atkinson, who I'm sure, some consider to be a problematic woman, I imagine. Maybe even Attorney General Eric Holder would, former Attorney General Eric Holder would consider Cheryl Atkinson to be a problematic woman. It was Cheryl Atkinson, after all, who broke on broadcast television the story of Operation Fast and Furious. And she, along with everybody else who has been covering that story since the beginning, still has a lot of unanswered questions about just how it was that that operation took place, how it was given the green light, given the obvious flaws in what the investigation was supposed to do, who approved this, how far up the chain of command did it go. Again, a lot of unanswered questions. We'll talk about it with Cheryl Atkinson. There's a brand new book out called The Smear, actually out today, as a matter of fact. And we'll also talk with Cheryl about her news program, Full Measure, with Cheryl Atkinson. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart joining us in hour two. In hour three, our friend Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum will be with us. And again, we're going to be talking more about the Peruta case today because it is such a big case. And it's not, look, it's not the last right to carry case that the Supreme Court's going to have the opportunity to consider. I mentioned the Peruta 2 case, but that's going to take several years to get back before the court. And in the meantime, you know, I got to say, it's really weird, these quote-unquote common-sense gun safety organizations who swear they're not anti-Second Amendment, who swear that they're actually supportive of concealed carry, seem awfully happy about what the Supreme Court did yesterday. Over at guns.com, Chris Edger has the quote from Every Town for Gun Safety. Eric Tershwell, litigation director for Every Town for Gun Safety, said in a statement, I remember Every Town is expending a great deal of time and energy to push this narrative that they love the Second Amendment. They're not anti-gun. They're certainly not in favor of gun control. They just want a few simple gun safety measures, and they've said we support concealed carry. He said the Supreme Court's decision not to review Peruta versus the County of San Diego is a win for gun safety. The Peruta decision, consistent with four other federal appeals courts all across the country that have found the Second Amendment, leaves plenty of room for states and localities to make their own determinations about who can carry a concealed handgun in public. Now, that's many things, but that is not a statement in support of your right to carry. Because what the Supreme Court left unchanged is this two-tier system in California where most of the counties, self-defense is recognized as good cause, but in a few counties, which also happen to be the most populous counties in California, self-defense is not seen as good cause. And you can't get a license. But if you live in one of those counties where self-defense is seen as a valid reason to get a concealed carry license, you can carry anywhere in the state. You can carry into those counties where people who live there can't get a license. I find that just really odd. And very grateful to live in a state like Virginia where it's just shall issue. But I don't see how on earth you can take this position of, well, it's good to make sure that the residents of Los Angeles County can't carry, but the residents of Ventura County can carry into Los Angeles County. That doesn't make any sense to me. And these folks are supposed to be the common sense gun safety experts. The Second Amendment leaves plenty of room for states and localities to make their own determinations about who can carry a concealed handgun in public. Well, you know, this is, again, was one of the complaints of Justice Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch yesterday, that the reason why states have this leeway is because the Supreme Court hasn't said anything since 2010 when it comes to our right to keep and bear arms. During that same time period, Justice Thomas said the court has considered 35 cases dealing with the First Amendment, has dealt with 25 cases dealing with the Fourth Amendment, and has dealt with zero cases dealing with the Second Amendment. We only have Heller and McDonald. And then the guidance that the Supreme Court issued in the Catano case out of Massachusetts dealing with a ban on stun guns. But that's it. And as Justice Thomas pointed out in his written dissent yesterday, concurring with Justice Gorsuch, he said, look, We didn't address this issue directly in Heller McDonald because that wasn't the question. The question was whether or not this ban on handguns in the home passed constitutional muster. But look at what we said in our opinions. And, you know, we talk about the definition of bearing arms, meaning outside of the home. He said there's no way, it's inconceivable. He said that the framers, the people who wrote the Bill of Rights, would have meant that bearing arms meant carrying your gun from your bedroom to your kitchen. I think he said extraordinarily implausible. And it is. But the quote-unquote gun safety, totally supportive of the right to conceal carry every time for gun safety, says they're pleased with this decision. Again, I don't know anybody who is supportive of concealed carry who is pleased with this decision. Because what this decision does, it does not leave plenty of room for states and localities to make their own determinations about who can carry a concealed handgun in public. It allows states and localities to say, if you live here, your rights don't apply. That's what it does. If you live here, this right in particular doesn't apply. We're going to restrict it. And, you know, in the McDonald case, which dealt with Chicago's ban on handguns, the Supreme Court said, look, not only is the Second Amendment protected against federal intrusion, So D.C.'s gun ban was unconstitutional. D.C.'s a federal district of Columbia. Not only does that fail to pass constitutional muster, but states and localities, the Supreme Court said, can't infringe on your rights either. So they incorporated the Second Amendment, what's called the incorporation doctrine, using the 14th Amendment, incorporating this against state and local intrusion as well. So, yes, it doesn't get rid of the ability of local communities to regulate the right, but they can't infringe that right. And when you're telling people that if you live in Los Angeles County, San Francisco County, Marin County, Alameda County, San Diego County, I think there are three or four others in California, that you can't carry a firearm for self-defense, can't carry it openly, not even unloaded, can't carry it concealed because we're not going to give you a license, you're not just regulating that right. You are infringing on that right because you're taking something that they can do under the Constitution and telling them that they can't, that there's no way that they're going to be able to do this. That, by the way, was the argument in the original Ninth Circuit decision in Peruta, the three-judge panel that got overturned by the en banc review. I think it was Judge Kaczynski who, I know it wasn't Judge Kaczynski. I got to go back and find out who wrote the, Judge O'Scanlan, Dermot O'Scanlan, who wrote the majority opinion in that case and said, again, you can have regulations for the concealed carrying of firearms. That's fine. You can even have may issue concealed carry if you want. You can have very, very restrictive issue for concealed carry if you want. But there needs to be another way for folks to carry. There needs to be another way for folks to legally be able to bear arms. And in California right now, there's not. So this goes beyond a regulation. This goes into infringement. And this is why the law can't stand. And unfortunately, again, doesn't look like right now we have five votes on the Supreme Court to recognize what is so obvious in the reading of the Second Amendment and in the history of this country, including the current history of this country, that we are a nation who cares very much about our right to keep and bear arms, including the bear part. We've got what, according to Pew, 30% of Americans own a gun. And of the 30% of Americans who own a gun, they say about 40-something percent say they carry a gun nearly every day. That's tens of millions of Americans who are exercising this right at this moment. Tens of millions. And that number, again, would be millions more if people could legally carry in places like L.A. County, in San Francisco, Manhattan, Washington, D.C. Millions more Americans right now are deprived of that right. They can't exercise it. They're told by their state and local governments, no, it's not for you. And we know, by the way, that these state and local governments, in many cases, would tell these individuals, you can't own a gun in your home either. How do we know this? Because they have. Because these jurisdictions have told people that your Second Amendment rights actually don't even exist. It's some collective right to belong to a militia. That's what you possess. But you don't have a right to own a gun for self-defense even in your home. We've heard anti-gun activists, we've heard anti-gun politicians tell us this. Some of the same folks, by the way, who now talk about how much they love the Second Amendment, how much they respect it, including our right to carry. All right, when we come back, Chuck Michelle is going to be with us from Michelle and Associates. We're going to talk more about the Peruta case, talk about the other lawsuits. We've got a deadline coming up again on a brand new law in California going into effect on July the 1st. And more importantly, where do we go from here when it comes to our right to carry? Stick around. Much more Cam and Company coming up right after this. Talking with Ron Sasaki from AmericanSnipers.org. In case people haven't ever heard of AmericanSnipers.org, what is the mission of this group?
Okay, what our mission is we help equip our military snipers. If they have any equipment needs when they're getting deployed, if they can't get equipment through their normal chain of command, they get a hold of us, and we gift that gear to them. No cost to them. We operate solely on donations. We're 100% nonprofit, all-volunteer organization. So we're just trying to help these guys out as they're going downrange.
And this is really, I think, a brotherhood that got started here. I mean, you've got a law enforcement, military members who were instrumental, I mean, in putting this together. This started with one guy helping one guy, and it kind of snowballed from there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it started, most of us have a law enforcement background. We're all current or former SWAT snipers. So in the early 2000s, we had some of our brother snipers getting deployed in various units, and they found out there was an equipment shortage at that time. So they asked for some gear, and it got donated, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. So we've been going strong ever since. You know, kind of slowed down with the units getting deployed over the last few years, but of course things are starting to ramp back up again.
Absolutely. And you know, you talk about the slowdown, but it never really disappears because, you know, a lot of these guys are, they're kind of operating in the shadows. They're not operating in the theaters where we see a lot of headlines about combat. Some of these missions are taking place in places where we don't necessarily even think about guys being on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And because it hasn't been on the headlines, people kind of forget about them. And then, you know, so their budgets shrink, too. So we are still supporting some of those guys, even some of the, you know, the bigger units that are doing a lot of work overseas. So we've got a lot of equipment that's been going out. So, you know, all the donations and being able to be here at the NRA show has been great. That really helps out a lot.
That's fantastic. And just give me an example of like some of the type of equipment that you will provide these guys. What are they not getting?
Well, it's mostly sniper-specific equipment that we provide. So it's a lot of binoculars, range finders, spotting scopes, the Kestrel wind meters, a lot of those things that the guys ask for that they have a tough time getting to their normal chain of command. We operate solely on donations. So if you can go to AmericanSnipers.org, you can donate there, or you can buy some of our T-shirts and hats and challenge coins, and that's what helps us out.
Here at the Congressional Shootout with Congressman Rob Whitman of Virginia. Tell me why people, us in Northern Virginia, should get the hell out of there and come visit you guys.
Well, down on the Northern Neck where I live is really sportsman's paradise. If you like hunting, a great place to be. Lots of great shooting sports opportunities down there as well as fishing. So a great, great area. I'm blessed to live there. Live in the little tiny town of Montrose, population 350. Can walk out my back door and hear the turkeys gobbling and hear the wood ducks and the geese fly over back to roost in the pond behind the house. So it's a great, great place. I'm blessed to live there and get to travel home every evening from D.C. there.
Yeah, you're a lucky man. You get to get out of D.C. You know, so we've seen these stories recently, Congressman, these very vitriolic, angry town halls. You talk about living in your town where people have, I'm sure, direct access to you. Saw one video yesterday. You know, someone attacked a congressman, grabbed his collar. It's getting really ugly, sir. What have you seen?
You know, we've tried to make sure we're engaging folks in ways that are most productive to have a civil conversation. It becomes very difficult, I think, if you have these large town halls. We've met with a lot of these groups that obviously have different viewpoints on things, but we meet with them in a smaller context, smaller groups, to where we can actually have a civil conversation back and forth. It is disturbing when you see that, and I think all of us want to have those civil dialogues with folks, but it is disturbing if they get to a point where people are either hollering and screaming to where others can't talk or listen, and then two, if they want to act out in those situations. So I just think people need to take a breath. We understand there's some difference of opinion out there, but you know, we're all about making sure that our process works and having a civil discourse. No matter where you are, how passionate you are about your issues, I think it's all about having that civil discourse in this nation. And, you know, what we've done is to try to look at ways where we can make sure we encourage that and assure that even if people are passionate about what they talk about, that we can do it in a way that's productive, where we're respectful of everybody's viewpoint and make sure, too, that it's not about volume, it's about substance.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Oh, we're getting ready for my favorite time of year, Independence Day. Having a conversation with my wife about this because I got to go to the fireworks stand at some point. Halloween is her big, like, holiday to do stuff. We have a Halloween party every year. Independence Day is my holiday.
All right. That's the day that's just let me plan everything. We'll have a good time. I'm looking forward to it coming up next week. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Chuck Michelle from Michelle and Associates out in California, one of the attorneys working long and hard on the Peruta case. Chuck, thank you, sir, for your time today.
Cam, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. And first of all, let me just say on behalf of gun owners everywhere, including there in California, thank you for your efforts with the Peruta case. You and I have been talking about this case for years now, and you know, on the one hand, I'm disappointed that the Supreme Court didn't hear this case. On the other hand, I guess I'm relieved if we don't have the five votes that they didn't hear this case.
Right, and I think the fifth vote is still iffy. You know, we know we have a pretty solid four, though, because Justice Gorsuch signed on to the dissent to the denial of the cert request in the Peruta case. So he came out, I think he sent a message by joining that dissent to gun owners everywhere that he's on our side. Mm-hmm. And that is really, that's a good thing. Folks need to keep the big picture in mind, especially the folks in California. Do not lose hope over this. This was not the be-all, end-all. We will be back. I wish I could say that with an Arnold Schwarzenegger accent, but we already have another case coming up in front of the Supreme Court next term, the Bauer case. It's basically a poll tax being imposed on gun buyers. We have the Colby case. We have the CCW cases in D.C. or the carry cases, public carry cases in D.C. And we, you know, as lawyers, we hope for the best, but we plan for all contingencies. And this was definitely something we had to plan for. You know, 99 out of 100 cases the Supreme Court doesn't take. So just statistically, we had to prepare for that possibility. And so we've got the Flanagan case out here already. It's not like the Supreme Court has said there is no right to carry. All the Supreme Court did was not take the case that would have decided that issue. So we're going to continue to push cases to the Supreme Court that will resolve the issue of the standard, the appropriate standard of review, not just for public carry cases, but for all the cases, all the, you know, the challenges to the types of gun bans, the types of people bans, the types of places bans, and all the other miscellaneous stuff. We are attacking those types of laws in California, and the NRA has a litigation going on across the country. So all the stuff that was enacted last year, that's all being challenged in court sooner or later, and I think it's going to be fairly soon, as in maybe next term if Justice Kennedy retires. The Supreme Court is going to take a case, and I believe when they do, they're going to set the lower courts straight and make sure that those lower courts understand that the Supreme Court meant what it said in the Heller and McDonald cases.
Well, you know, and there's, boy, there's a lot to unpack there. But let's talk about this, because, as you said, the Supreme Court didn't say, no, there's no right to carry. They didn't take this case. And in fact, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals didn't say there's no right to carry. They said the question was whether or not there is a constitutional right to carry a concealed firearm in public, which was a question that nobody had asked until the Ninth Circuit decided to answer that question. But that broader question, as you say, Chuck, of whether or not the right to bear arms actually means anything was left unaddressed by both the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit. And you talk about the Flanagan case. This, you know, again, you got to go back to the beginning here and start over. But there are still a lot of unlitigated issues dealing specifically with the right to carry in California, and we are going to get another crack at this.
That's right. I mean, and maybe several. Once we get that fifth vote locked in, and this is where we all have to stop and genuflect towards Fairfax, Virginia, and thank the NRA for getting Donald Trump in office, because Donald Trump is the reason we have Gorsuch and the reason that we will have the next pro-Second Amendment justice on that court. That's why we're in a position to still win, and I think we will. God forbid if the election had gone differently, we would not be.
Okay, so let me ask you that, because if there were five votes to say no, there's no right to carry, presumably then you'd have those four justices ready to get on board and hear this case, because they'd know that all right, we've got the votes for it to go our way. It sounds like what you're saying is, that Justice Gorsuch replacing Antonin Scalia ensured that block remained intact, so that the outcome of these cases remain in doubt. Do you, and I realize this is rampant speculation, Chuck, but do you get the sense that that this is an open question before the court right now, and neither side eager to see the court address this when there are still some question marks about how the justices would decide this case?
Well, okay, so I'm going to, you know, swirl my tea leaves here, and as long as everybody understands, that's all I'm doing.
Yes, this is just your opinion based on, you know, what the little evidence that we have available to us. But yes, go ahead.
The conjecture would be, remember, the numbers here are, it takes 4 votes to take the case, 5 votes to win it. If you don't have 5 votes, the 4 votes that might take the case, that might usually vote to take the case, don't necessarily vote to take the case.
Mm-hmm.
So if our four friends on that court and one of the judges was wishy-washy, say, for example, Justice Kennedy, those 4 votes, Roberts, Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas, that might be on our side, might not all get together and vote to take that case because they're not sure they have the 5th vote. So then you get into, well, what is it that 5th vote is looking for? What kind of a case? Because Kennedy signed on to Heller and McDonald. Mm-hmm. So what's he looking for? Maybe he's worried. Maybe he's a little nervous about public carry. Maybe he wants something that's a little more benign to be the next step, you know. But because remember, one of the big questions that needs to be answered is the standard of review. In other words, the degree of scrutiny that any gun law is going to get from the court. And, that's not something that has to be resolved in a public carry case. It can be resolved in any Second Amendment challenge, potentially. So maybe he's thinking, I want to decide this in a different context. Or maybe he's thinking, I'm out of here, so I don't really want to be part of this particular decision. I'll let the next guy do it. I'll swirl my teacup again, and I'll give you a different read. But that seems like one definite possibility.
All right. I think that's a pretty good reading of the tea leaves, frankly. Now, Chuck, let me ask what we've got here, because July the 1st, we've got a new law going into effect in California, right? The ban on magazines over 10 rounds?
Yes. And we are waiting with bated breath for the San Diego Federal District Court to decide whether or not they're going to grant the NRA-CRPA request for an injunction to stop that magazine possession ban from going into effect. We briefed that and argued in court about a week ago, and the judge promised he'd try and have the decision out as soon as he could. It sounded good in the courtroom. I'm knocking on wood as I say this. You know, he was giving us a lot of signs that he was agreeing with what we were with our position. And so we're hopeful that we might actually get an injunction issued that would stop the state from enforcing that magazine possession ban. Meantime, we have probably the most massive case of civil disobedience going on in history out here, because all the law enforcement agencies are reporting that no one is turning in these magazines. So we'll just have to see. We're waiting, like I said, for that court to rule, and the folks just have to stay tuned. But we're hopeful.
What is the what's the penalty if you are found in possession of one of these magazines after the law has gone into effect, Chuck?
Good question. Because if you remember, both Proposition 63 had a magazine possession ban, and then the state passed another magazine possession ban. So there's these redundant laws enacted. But one set up a misdemeanor penalty and one set up an infraction penalty. So there's probably going to wind up being litigation over which one of those penalties is really the appropriate penalty. And maybe it'll be that it could be an infraction, up to the DA to decide, the prosecutor to decide if they want to charge it as a misdemeanor or infraction. I got a feeling some jurisdictions, prosecutorial jurisdictions, like friendly ones, and there are a lot of red counties out here,
mm-hmm.
more red counties than blue counties. They just have a lot less people in them. But those counties are not, those counties are not going to make busting people with a magazine a priority. And if they have to bust somebody, they'll be inclined to probably go the lenient route. But folks need to understand, I mean, you need to make a fully informed decision if you're going to keep these things. I respect people who want to be engaging in civil disobedience, but, you know, it's We don't need test cases. We've already got a case challenging this. We don't need martyrs, and folks shouldn't expect that. You know, the gun rights advocacy groups are going to marshal their forces outside the courtroom and protest their trial. It doesn't work that way. They peel you off one by one, and so folks need to think carefully about how they're going to respond. I respect their decision either way, but folks need to understand what the ramifications could be.
Absolutely. And look, there are some county sheriffs I've seen who said we're not really going to be enforcing this. Some have said, you know, look, if it's another charge we can tack on to a gang member or somebody that we bust for a violent crime, sure, we'll use that. But that's one of the reasons why I asked about the penalties, because, you know, again, Chuck, this was billed as a crime-fighting measure, right? This is going to crack down on criminals with these large-capacity magazines. The violent criminal is not going to care much about whether this is an infraction or a misdemeanor, because he's likely going to be facing felony charges for the armed robbery, the carjacking, the drive-by shooting, or whatever.
Or the murder, yeah.
Right.
That's the joke of all of
this. This is a law that is aimed directly at people who are trying to stay on the right side of the law, those people who are law-abiding citizens. This is a law that is not aimed at the criminals. It's aimed squarely at the law-abiding people in California.
Exactly. On some theory that somehow criminals get them from law-abiding citizens. Of course, there's millions and hundreds of millions of these magazines in the country, and if they were right, which they're not, that criminals steal them from law-abiding California gun owners, and even if they were right that those gun owners will no longer have these magazines, which isn't going to be the case, those criminals can go get these magazines in any other state in the country. So, or not use them, for crying out loud, because you don't have to have a magazine that holds over 10 rounds to commit a crime. So it's never really been about what they try and say it's about. They couch these laws in terms of increased public safety, but the reality is it has nothing to do with that. It's about an agenda that the progressives out here, the statists out here, the politicians that believe in big government and anti-state, want to advance. And it's becoming more and more obvious out here in California, not just with guns, but everything else they're doing these days as they butt heads with the Trump administration.
Talking again with Mr. Chuck Michel. You can find Chuck on Twitter at Michel Lawyers, M-I-C-H-E-L Lawyers. And, you know, Chuck, just getting back to the concealed carry issue, if we can, for just a second, because as you mentioned, there are a lot of, quote unquote, red counties. There are a lot of counties in California where the sheriff or the issuing authority says, yeah, self-defense, that's good cause for a concealed carry license. And those folks, they can carry right now in San Diego County, in L.A. County, in Ventura County, right? It's not like their concealed carry license only applies to their home county.
That's right.
I want folks to understand how inexplicable this current system is, because I'm looking at a quote from the litigation director at Everytown for Gun Safety, praising the court's decision to stay away from Peruta because this shows that these states and localities can craft their finely tuned gun laws. Well, no, they can't, because there are people outside of their control who are legally carrying in L.A., in San Francisco right now. I guarantee it, despite their best efforts. It's not about crafting local control. It's about trying to keep as many people as possible away from their rights.
That's right. And we're doing a public education drive right now to let folks know that as a result of Peruta, the three-judge panel Peruta case, an awful lot of issuing agencies, police departments and sheriffs, came to realize that they think more like that three-judge panel than like that en banc, the judges that ruled in that en banc decision. They like the way the judges in that three-judge panel think. They're conservative thinkers. They're going to adopt that approach. And so we have actually got more jurisdictions issuing more licenses to carry in public in California than ever before. A lot of people don't even realize that their city or county has gone shall issue. And so we're going to be making that a priority to let people know that so that they can apply for these permits and we'll get more of these permits issued out here.
I think that's absolutely fantastic that you're doing that, because this is, you know, whether or not the Supreme Court takes this into consideration, the more people we have exercising this right, the more demand that we can show for this. And you look at what happened in Orange County when the sheriff for a few months started issuing concealed carry licenses. They went from like, 300 licenses or 300 applications a year to like 3,000 within a couple of months, Chuck, because people knew, oh, okay, I can get my license now. You're right. There are people in counties all across the state, I am sure, who have no idea that this is something that that is achievable where they live. They do need to be aware of that. And I think, you know, if they are, hopefully, you know, a year from now, the numbers are going to reflect that.
There's two things that get rid of gun owner apathy. You know, you got a lot of people who just have a gun in their dresser or drawer and they forget all about it and they don't engage in the Second Amendment advocacy and they're not activists. But once you get a license to carry, or once you get, you know, one of the guns that are a lot of fun to shoot, but they happen to be condemned as, you know, quote unquote assault weapons, those are the things that get people riled up. And that's what we want. We want people engaged, paying attention, worrying about whether or not their sheriff is a pro CCW or not, and voting, you know, engaged.
Talking again with Mr. Chuck Michelle, California civil rights attorney from Michelle and Associates. Chuck, as always, sir, thanks for all of your efforts.
Do you have one more minute? I got some breaking news for you.
Oh yes, I do. If there's breaking news,
you talked about the large capacity magazine restriction that was kicking in on July 1st. The DOJ was supposed to write regulations about that. The DOJ is also, the California Department of Justice Firearms Bureau is also supposed to be putting out regulations about how to register the guns that are now going to be considered assault weapons by virtue of the magazine disconnect lock, bullet button or whatever.
Well, yes.
We just got word, the DOJ had put those out initially. We submitted a comment letter saying these regulations are all messed up. The DOJ withdrew the regulations from the Office of Administrative Law. Then about a month later, they submitted them again to the OAL. We submitted another protest letter saying these regulations are inadequate and illegal. And we just got word that the OAL has rejected the DOJ's attempt to put these regulations through. So we've, in light of our letter, the OAL has now rejected the DOJ's attempt to enact these regulations. So they're now going to have to go back to the drawing board. They've already gotten an extension from December 31st to July of next year to set up the registration system. They're probably going to need more time because they just can't get it right.
Unbelievable. Not a full reprieve, but a stay of this a law going into effect, and some good news, Chuck. Again, this is all because of the efforts of gun owners around the country, those particularly in California who are standing and fighting for their rights, and we can stand and fight with them no matter where we live. Chuck, thanks so much for your time, sir. Congratulations on that bit of good news today, and thanks for sharing the breaking news with us.
We'll get some more out on that, Cam, and I'm happy to come back anytime and talk about all these things. Appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure, sir. Chuck Michelle joining us here on Cam and Company. Kelsey Harkness writing at the Federalist, Nasty Women. She says targeting the problematic women. They're not going anywhere. Okay, we'll talk about that with Kelsey coming up right after this. So stick around. There's much more Cam and Company on the way. Let's talk about Diversity Shoot. How long have you been doing that?
I've been doing the Diversity Shoot since February 2015. Right after Sandy Hook, New Jersey, like a bunch of places, lost their mind, and they tried to reduce our magazine capacity from 15 to 10 and pass a lot of different laws. I got actively involved then, and I went to testify. 200 pro-gun people came and testified. The day before the testimony, the committee told the newspapers how they were going to vote, and we were going to lose. While we were there, they were playing video games on their phone. It really was annoying. So I looked out, and I was the only African-American that was pro-gun at the event. And I'm like, there are lots of people of color that shoot. Why don't we come out? So I contacted Second Amendment groups in the state, and I said, do you have something to recruit African-Americans, minorities into your group to get them to participate politically? No one had anything. So I contacted Anthony Calandro from Gun for Hire, and I asked him on February 1st, how do I get something like this going? February 9th, we had our first event.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so what's the response been? Who's coming out to these events?
Everyone is coming out to these events, black, white, Hispanic, women, men. My friend Sean from Black Bag Resources, he was the one that said, Tony, are you going to talk about it or are you going to be about it? I was like, I guess I got to be about it. So I actually got involved. And people have been showing up to the point, I'm the gun guy at work, and that's a heavy load to carry sometimes. But one of the guys says, my mom always wanted to shoot a gun. Her birthday's coming up. When is your event? I told him when my event was. He showed up with his mom. Her first gun she shot was my Glock 19. And that was provided by one of the ladies from Second Amendment Women's Shooting Club. They and all the Second Amendment groups all joined together at that event. She shot a Glock 19. She shot 22s. She ended up probably shooting a 308 by my friend Orlando Martinez. He brought a Springfield Armory Scout Squad. This lady had never shot a gun before 2 hours earlier. End of the day, she's banging it out with a 308. So I thought I'd never see her again. She showed up at the next event with her daughter and two friends. That's how you grow the Second Amendment. We all can do it. Bring a new person to the range, be a good representative, and only talk about guns. Don't talk about politics, nothing else. We're talking about the civil right of Second Amendment. And if you want to help me out, you can join and come to diversityshoot.com. And if you're outside and if you're in a gun-friendly state, donate to states that aren't gun-friendly. Help us out. We need it.
Absolutely. Talking again with Tony Simon. And Tony, you know, kind of piggybacking off of that, I think we've seen – so you've got gays against guns. You've got we're really seeing, like, anti-gun groups try to slice and dice this and go after particular demographics, right, including African-Americans, including Hispanics, including the LGBT community. I think gun owners are fighting back organically, as you say, with things like this. But what would you tell somebody – Who would say to you, Tony, listen, man, I don't want to go to the NRA annual meeting. You know, I'm a minority. I'm gonna be walking around in a sea of white people, and I'm gonna feel uncomfortable. They're gonna make, you know, like there is, I think, this attitude for people who don't know what it's like to be here, what it's like to talk to NRA members. So what would you tell folks about the NRA and the members that you've met?
I'll say what I said at my last event. I asked everyone to raise their hand that had a firearms ID card in the area. That's what you have to have in New Jersey to be able to even touch a gun in a gun store. Everyone raised their hands. I said, look around if you're not a gun owner. All of these people had multiple background checks. If you got in a room in your church, you can't get this many people to raise their hand that had multiple background checks. We're good people. We're good people at the range. We're good people at home. And they're good people here. We're all gun people. We all believe in the Second Amendment right to bear arms. And it's really a bunch of good people. Give it a chance. This is my second one, and I'm going to all the ones in the future.
All right, well, we will see you in Dallas next year. I'll probably see you in New Jersey before then.
Yes.
But listen, man, thanks not just for talking the talk, but for walking the walk and being an activist there in New Jersey. You're absolutely right. These battleground states, it's critical that we've got men and women like you who are actually, you know, boots on the ground, spreading the word, bringing in people one at a time. You're making a difference. You're making a change. And I got to tell you, man, I'm really, really glad that we ran into each other today.
Yep, I really appreciate it. Understand, as gun owners, we got it made. There are no anti-gun parties. There are no anti-gun barbecues. We have barbecue guns. We have a good time. We have fun, and we spread freedom. You should recruit people into this family of gun owners. This is very important. To make the Second Amendment last another generation, it's up to this generation to bring new people in.
Welcome back. Thanks again for tuning in to Cam and Company. Next hour, Cheryl Atkinson joins us, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins. And right now, from the Daily Signal, but writing at the Federalist, Kelsey Harkness is with us. Kelsey, how are you today?
Great. Thank you. How are you?
I am good. It's good talking with you. I think last time we chatted was, I think it was at CPAC. We were talking about your recent trip to the range, and today your target, Elle Magazine, which has decided that some women are just problematic, Kelsey.
Yes, well, Elle Magazine, which claims to represent women, had the audacity to publish an article with the headline asking the question, how do we criticize problematic women? And when reading the article, you come to find out that who are these problematic women? Well, they're Ivanka Trump, they're Megyn Kelly, they're Kellyanne Conway, they're Theresa May. They're basically any female who is either moderate or conservative and doesn't agree with this whole nasty woman narrative. So as someone who self-identifies as a problematic woman, I felt the need to respond.
Okay. So what is your response? How, first of all, do you think that you need to be dealt with?
Well, at first it might be tempting to be offended by this terminology, to be called a problematic woman. That implies that you are a problem that doesn't need to be debated with or swayed to change their mind. You're a problem that just needs to be fixed. So the whole premise is pretty insulting, but if you actually really think about it, and this is what I write about in my article in The Federalist, problematic women should be proud of this new title. We should wear it as proud as the nasty woman, march around with their signs and their pink hats and embrace their title as being nasty woman, because the reality is being a problem in society is how feminism all got started. Women never made any progress by just swimming with the tide, going with the flow. Women really made change when they stood up in society and were problems. And right now, I actually think it's highly problematic that women on the left are telling women on the right exactly how they need to think and feel and vote. That's the real problem.
And did you, you wrote that the author of this piece said that an attack on a woman's physical attributes is justifiable when her politics are wrong?
Yes, so this writer at Elle really was trying to figure out, how do we criticize women like Megyn Kelly when they come under attack for the way they look? And she concludes that although she doesn't seem to outwardly support these attacks, they are somehow justifiable because their politics are all wrong, which is basically justifying sexist stereotypes and attacks against women, which is everything that the feminist sisterhood claims to be against.
Yeah, but again, when it's problematic women, it's okay, right? Different rules.
Exactly,
I find this fascinating.
Actually,
yeah, no, go ahead. Finish your thought.
This is why they actually had to address the question of how to criticize problematic women. It's ironic that they actually had to publish this article, because it is difficult for them to criticize conservative women when everything their movement stands for is empowering and lifting up your fellow sister. And so they are somehow in this article trying to figure out how to appropriately do that. And in doing so, they come to justify calling Kellyanne Conway, for example, Skeletor.
Unbelievable. But again, the premise is not how to have a conversation with someone you disagree with, right? The premise is, how do you criticize these women who you disagree with? And apparently, calling them less of a woman is okay, right? They can be. In fact, Kelsey, I mean, isn't this really just ultimately about calling somebody you're not an authentic woman, Kelsey, if you're not standing up for all of these things that that Elle supports and Elle believes in?
Well, exactly. And I really think that there's a really dangerous bullying culture right now in the female space, where particularly younger women and girls, and even my age, we are bullied out of posting publicly our beliefs on politics and the way we vote. It's not only if you don't speak publicly about the Women's March, but if you didn't actually go there in March, you were subject to a lot of attacks by fellow females. And so this whole idea that you can't be a woman and you can't be a feminist and you can't be for female empowerment unless you are very pro abortion and all the far-reaching policies that the feminist movement now stands for, you can't be a part of their pact. It's very hypocritical when it comes down to it. And so that's why my message to my fellow females out there is, really be a proud problematic woman. I certainly am.
what do proud problematic women read? Because I imagine it's not Elle. They can read Bright, right? They can read that newsletter.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. So Bright is a morning newsletter for women by women. It's a little similar to The Skim, but I'd say maybe a little more moderate and conservative leaning. And it's a combination of updates on important news updates about what's happening on the Hill and in politics, but also a few news stories to brighten up your morning, because we all know we need a little bit of those. So I would encourage anyone listening, it's particularly if you're a problematic woman, I really think that you would like Bright. You can sign up, getbrightemail.com. I also love reading The Federalist and The Daily Signal. And of course, tuning into NRA News, I have covered a lot of the Second Amendment debates, and I always look forward to coming back to those.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we always love talking with you, Kelsey. Thank you so much for speaking up, speaking out, and we look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thank you, Cam.
You bet. Kelsey Harkness from The Daily Signal. Again, you can find her latest at The Federalist. Nasty women targeting problematic women, and the problematic women not going anywhere. All right. Coming up next hour, Cheryl Atkison, host of Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. Also, the brand new book, The Smear, is out today. How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote. Cheryl says the trick of the smear is that it's often based on some shred of truth, but these media-driven hit pieces are designed to obscure the truth. Success hinges on the smear artist's ability to remain invisible, to make it seem as if their work is neither calculated nor scripted. It must appear to be precisely what it is not. And Cheryl has a lot of experience with the smear artists. We'll talk about that next year, but we'll also talk about Operation Fast and Furious. And, you know, look, there was some smearing going on there, right? I mean, you had Obama administration officials contacting Cheryl Atkinson's boss at CBS, basically telling the boss, stop. Stop with these stories. Tell Cheryl to stop. Move on. Go on to another story here. And, you know, we did see Cheryl Atkinson, I think, presented and portrayed, once she started reporting things like Operation Fast and Furious, all of a sudden, to certain members of the left, she sort of had lost that objectivity, right? Because she was questioning something that was happening under the Obama administration. So that automatically made her suspect. Is Cheryl Atkinson a right-wing crank? Is that what's going on here? So sad to see what's happened to Cheryl Atkinson. I mean, she used to be such a great journalist, and then she started covering Obama like she's covered other administrations. Yeah, it was gross to see. But Cheryl Atkinson still fighting, and we'll talk with her next hour. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins joins us next hour as well. Meanwhile, in the couple of minutes that we have left this hour, boy, there's a lot to talk about. Let's talk about what's going on in Milwaukee, where the police chief last night, part of a public forum on violent crime in Milwaukee. Fox 6 in Milwaukee says it served as an opportunity for neighbors to ask blunt questions of officials. The conversation covered some controversial subjects, including guns. At the Wisconsin Black Historical Society on Monday evening, Arizona-based policing expert Michael Scott, not the Michael Scott who used to work at Dunder Mifflin, by the way, different Michael Scott, promoted problem-oriented policing. Said the three keys to problem-oriented policing: neighborhood knowledge, crime data analysis, and community partnership. If you note, gun control was not among those three things. He says if you've got those three elements and police management that is supportive of this work, you've got 90% of what you need to do this policing. Fox 6 says that Chief Ed Flynn was asked about whether Wisconsin's concealed carry law contributes to the violent crime in Milwaukee. Flynn said that it does, because only convicted felons are barred from permits. He said so-called human holsters with cleaner records hold guns for big-time drug dealers. Yeah. He said it's an irresponsible law passed by irresponsible legislators who are more interested in ideological points, and I'd sure as hell like some more community outrage about that, because that's what's driving the violence in this city. And too many public officials, he says, are silent about it. So the chief of police in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, says that what is driving the violent crime in Milwaukee are licensed, legal, concealed carry holders. That, he says, are the individuals who are driving violent crime. It's amazing. Everywhere, Baltimore, Maryland, record high number of homicides. They don't have concealed carry there. So they don't have to worry about concealed carry holders. Imagine how much worse it would be if people could actually carry a gun legally to protect themselves. Los Angeles, California, L.A. County, violent crime up last 3 years running. No concealed carry holders there. But in Milwaukee, for some reason, it's concealed carry holders who are driving the violence. Now, this is, to put it bluntly, crap. Okay? In Wisconsin, you've got about 320,000 concealed carry holders right now. And less than 1% of concealed carry licenses are revoked for any reason whatsoever. Over the past 5 years, there have been a grand total of less than 1,000 concealed carry licenses revoked for any type of crime. Any type of crime leading to a revocation. This is absurd to blame the rise in violent crime in Milwaukee on concealed carry holders, to say that's what's driving the violence. Now, here's the good news. The chief's comments were not left unanswered. And in fact, it was another law enforcement official who spoke up and spoke out. We'll tell you about it coming up after this. So stick around. There's much more Cam and Company on the way.
Talking with some of the folks from Hillsdale College up in Michigan, Colin Stockdale. How are you, sir?
Very good.
And happy Bill, it's good to talk with you. Bill Frame from AccuSport, but also a member of the board of directors of Hillsdale. Is that right?
Trustees of Hillsdale College.
Wow.
Yes, sir.
So I got to ask you, Bill, why do you support Hillsdale? Why are you on the board of trustees?
Well, Hillsdale, for me, really has a passion in my heart for what they represent. The school is a strong bent toward our Constitution, toward freedom and liberty. The school's been in existence since 1844. When you put all those things together and you can't support that, I don't know what you can't support. So I'm a proud proponent of the school and just pleased as I can be to be part of it. Been very instrumental as well as helping the school with the shooting sports. A whole shooting sports program. The school's been very successful in that, too. So
absolutely. I mean, I'm just looking here at some of the material. And Calvin, you know, it is kind of unusual for a college to tout its shooting facilities, its champion shotgun team.
Yeah.
I love it. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I love it. But this is a little different.
Hillsdale's an unusual place. Hillsdale doesn't take any government money, so we're one of the few truly private schools left in America. We teach the Constitution to every student that comes through our doors. And we have a big shooting sports program. So we're a little bit outside the box, a little unusual for a college. One of the few colleges here at the NRA show, actually. And we, as Bill said, we have a big shooting sports program, big team. They just won their fifth national championship in 6 years of competition as a team. So they're doing very well. We had last year 300 students signed up in rifle, shotgun, and pistol classes. That's 20% of our student body.
Wow.
So very popular among our students.
That is awesome. And getting more popular, I would imagine?
Yes, very much so. Well, we have a big facility that we've been building out over the last 6 or 7 years. And so this facility has all of the Olympic shooting sports in one location once it's completed. We're only about 75% completed at this point. But we'll have, right now we're focused mostly on shotgun sports. But we will eventually have rifle, pistol, and archery as well.
Maybe Hillsdale will be the first collegiate three-gun team. How about that?
There you go.
You'll be the champion because you'll be the only one.
It's not hard to be a big fish in a small pond.
I think it is fantastic because, again, not only, Bill, as you said, are you teaching about the Constitution. You're teaching about where these rights were enshrined, why they were enshrined in the Constitution. They weren't created by the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. But then you get that practical exercise of the Second Amendment. And I'm guessing that you guys are just as high on the First Amendment as well.
That's right. Yes, we very much are. Studying the Constitution and our founding documents, Federalist Papers, and actually going back even before the United States, clear back into ancient Greco-Roman heritage, and then through the Enlightenment with Locke and Hume and Rousseau and all of those political thinkers that undergird the American founding. Those people are critical to understanding who we are today and where our rights come from.
And that's not the only online course that you offer, right? You offer more than a dozen courses now.
We do, yeah. As of this semester, we will have 15 online courses available, not only on the Constitution, but also on economics, American and Western heritage. Those are history courses. We have theology courses. We have English courses, literature courses. So there's lots of different options out there for anybody's particular flavor or interest.
All right. All we got to do, just go to hillsdale.edu.
That's correct. Yes. Thank you so much.
Hey, Calvin, thank you, sir. Bill, a real pleasure.
Good to see you. Thank you, Cam.
Good to see you. We'll hopefully get a chance to talk again very soon. So there you go. Hillsdale College, hillsdale.edu, celebrating and teaching about the Second Amendment.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. On the program this hour, we have Cheryl Atkison, host of Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison, the brand new book, The Smear, out today. Also, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins going to join us on the program a little bit later on in the hour. But I want to continue this story out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at a meeting last night on public safety. The police chief there, Ed Flynn, said that the concealed carry law in Wisconsin is a, quote, irresponsible law passed by irresponsible legislators who are more interested in ideological points. And I'd sure as hell like some more community outrage about that, because that's what's driving the violence in this city. And too many public officials, he said, are silent about this. Yes, according to the police chief in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, concealed carry holders are driving the violent crime rate in that city. Now, this did not go unchallenged, thankfully. The president of the Milwaukee Police Association, the police union, in Milwaukee, the rank-and-file officers, as opposed to the chief of police, Mike Crivello, said, quote, I've never had a conversation with you, chief, relative to you displaying that we are arresting an overwhelming amount of people, or even one person who's committed a crime while carrying a CCW permit. The police chief said, I'm forbidden to tell the public when a CCW permit holder breaks the law. I'm forbidden by statute. Now, there are privacy concerns in the concealed carry legislation in Wisconsin. But again, what we know are that the number of revocations of concealed carry holders for any reason whatsoever, far below 1%. We're talking about a handful of cases and over 320,000 concealed carry holders each and every year. So in order for Chief Flynn to make that assertion that concealed carry holders are driving the violent crime in Milwaukee, we would be talking about people who had been arrested, people who had been charged, and people who had been convicted of a crime who were concealed carry holders that the chief knows about. The numbers simply aren't there. I'm sorry, chief. The numbers aren't there to document what it is that you're saying, that concealed carry holders are driving this violent crime wave. By the way, what's happened in the state of Wisconsin since violent crime, or since a concealed carry put on the books? I think it was back in 2010. I got to do some checking. Violent crime has gone up, like many states around the country, over the past couple of years. Homicide rate 2013 in the state of Wisconsin, 2.8. In 2015, it was 4.2. Now, is that limited only to Milwaukee? Because here's the other question. If concealed carry holders are driving the crime in Milwaukee, which they're not, but that's the assertion, then are concealed carry holders driving up violent crime in Green Bay and in Madison and Appleton and all of the other communities across Wisconsin? No evidence of that. Well, just as much evidence of that as there is that concealed carry holders are driving up violent crime there in the city of Milwaukee. Now, Chief Ed Flynn has been anti-concealed carry since day one. What's driving the violent crime in Milwaukee is the same thing that's driving the violent crime in Chicago, in Baltimore, Maryland, in Washington, D.C., in L.A., St. Louis, Memphis, Tennessee. It is gang violence fueled by the drug trade, and we are seeing more of it. You know, the same time that we've seen this increase in violent crime over the last couple of years, what else have we seen on these streets over the last couple of years? A staggering increase in the number of overdose deaths, right? You've got gang members who are dealing not only in heroin and opioids, but meth deaths are up as well. The drug trade is booming in these inner cities. And by the way, what did the Obama administration do? Let out a lot of individuals, some of whom had violent criminal histories, but they were currently behind bars on drug charges. Granted them clemency, let them out early, back out on the streets. Some of them we've seen the news story, some of them already arrested, violating the law again. When you get unserious about serious crime, guess what happens? It's not that difficult to comprehend. But you've got to get serious about violent crime. Chief Flynn wants to get serious about concealed carry holders. So, and I would love to know, again, this was a public forum, so I don't know if there were any follow-ups, but I would love to know, does Chief Flynn really believe that the 320,000 Wisconsinites who are currently legally carrying, does he think that they should have to stop? Does he want to take those rights away? Because, again, we haven't seen one state in the union go back from shall issue right to carry. Not a single state in the United States, and there are more than 40 states right now that are shall issue when it comes to concealed carry. Not a single one has ever gone backwards and said, oh, that was a huge error on our part. We've got to make it really, really restrictive to get a concealed carry license. The movement in this country has been in one direction, towards the full recognition of our right to keep and to bear arms. Now, speaking of keeping and bearing arms, talked last hour with Chuck Michelle of Michelle and Associates about the new law going into effect in California on July the 1st, dealing with the ban on magazines over 10 rounds. We've got some other laws that are going into effect on July the 1st. In Kansas, campus carry goes into effect on the 1st of July. KWCH in Wichita, Kansas, says in order to have a concealed weapon on a college campus, a person must be 21 years or older. The firearm has to be concealed on or about the person at all times. Concealed carry allowed in all university buildings, except beyond the university police department's lobby, unless adequate security measures are put in place. Wichita State may designate a specific location as temporarily gun-free, such as athletics or commencement events where attendance is more than 5,000 people. Open carry prohibited on campus. And each person, who lawfully possesses a handgun on campus has to do so legally. You got to follow the law when you are carrying. That doesn't change, whether you're on a college campus or off a college campus. Campus carry going into effect in the state of Georgia on July the 1st as well. And I saw a couple of stories about faculty members who are thinking about leaving. There were a couple of other K-State professors who said, "Oh yeah, I'm out of here. I'm not going to continue teaching in this state where we've got campus carry now." Now they've been living in a state with concealed carry. In fact, they've been living in a state with constitutional carry. Presumably, they've not been afraid to leave their home. Presumably, they've gone out and gotten groceries, maybe gone out and had something to eat, maybe gone to the movies. Living in a state where this is the law has not bothered them. But working on a campus where this is the law is sending them out of state. Again, where's the common sense there? I don't get that. You're at work for 8 hours a day, the other 16 hours a day you're off campus, and you're in an environment where people can legally carry firearms. Now you're sleeping. Maybe you don't allow it in your home for 8 of those hours. But half the time that you're not at work, yeah, you're out and about, you're in society, and there are concealed carry holders there. The Kansan newspaper, the student newspaper at the University of Kansas, has a piece out. Faculty considers changing classroom practices as a result of campus carry. They're... The photo that they used to accompany the story is a close-up of a thigh, a jean-clad thigh, and a hand held down by the side with a gun in it, which, by the way, is not how you can legally carry on campus in Kansas. Not that there's any fear-mongering or anything going on about this issue. That's just, you know, the photo that they chose to run when it came to talking about campus carry. McKenna Hartford, the reporter there at the Daily Kansan, says in response to the arrival of concealed weapons on July the 1st as a result of a 2013 state law, professors are taking steps to adjust their teaching style, class content, office hours, or even seeking employment elsewhere. Aerospace engineering professor Ron Barrett Gonzalez, president of the Kansas chapter of the American Association of University Professors, says this is because many faculty members are concerned that concealed carry will have a chilling effect in classrooms. Professor Barrett Gonzalez says, I know a non-trivial number of faculty members who are changing their syllabus. What a number of faculty members are scaling back are some of those aspects that may be seen as terribly controversial. The chill that we are seeing in an active, open, and honest discourse is a continuous slide that, in my opinion, is an affront to our First Amendment and academic freedom, to which, again, I say, crap. That's crap, Professor. That is absolute crap. You're telling me that there are professors in Kansas right now who are changing what they're going to teach because of their fear, their hypothetical fear of what may happen under campus carry. And yet we look around and we see what actually is happening on college campuses around the country right now when it comes to professors not being able to speak their mind, not being able to share their opinions. And you're telling me that the problem are going to be those individuals who are legally and lawfully carrying a firearm? A problem, by the way, that you cannot document as actually existing in any state that has adopted campus carry. But that's why the professors are changing their teaching? I have no doubt that's why the professors say they're changing their teaching. But concealed carry holders are not a threat to academic freedom. You know who is a threat to academic freedom? Students and faculty members who don't want academic freedom. And there are plenty of those on campus right now, not just at the University of Kansas, not just at Evergreen State College, but all across the country. Professor Cecile Asilian, who teaches classes in the African and African American Studies Department, says she's concerned that this chilling effect will impact the quality of her classes. She said, at a conscious and subconscious level, I think it'll be very hard for me to be the same passionate teacher that I was this past semester. It's not just about my safety, she said, but the safety of the other students in this class. My students may become less critical thinkers. I will push them less, and in terms of my teaching, it will change. Why? Why? I don't understand. So last year, campus carry was illegal. Were you concerned about students hearing something controversial, standing up and wanting to punch you in the face? Were you concerned about a student disagreeing with another student, standing up and, putting them in a headlock, throwing them down the stairs of the classroom? Were you concerned about fistfights breaking out or physical assaults when your campus was supposedly, was legally gun-free? Were you concerned about physical violence breaking out? Because if you weren't, why would you be concerned now? We're talking about the same students. We're talking about people who are legally and lawfully carrying off campus all of the time. And you know what? They're engaging and they're interacting with people that they agree with and disagree with each and every day. And they're behaving lawfully and legally because that's who they are. So if you're concerned about your students suffering from equality and a critical thinking, yeah, I am too. I am too. But it has nothing to do with the changing of the syllabus. It has everything to do with the lack of critical thinking on this issue. The Daily Kansan says that Professor Barry Gonzalez says campus carry has driven some professors to rethink the way they teach. He said I understand that a non-trivial number of students, he's really big on that phrase, a non-trivial number of blank. A non-trivial number of students are uneasy being in a classroom where their classmates may be armed. I understand that. To accommodate to these students, I'm working to offer a virtual Dr. Barrett. English professor Mary Emma Graham says she won't be teaching classes this semester. Instead, will focus on the other aspects of her job, like research and mentoring. That's handy. Cameron, did you know that? Wow. Imagine if I came to work one day and I just said, you know, for the next 6 months, Cameron, I'm not going to focus on the actual broadcasting aspect of my job. I'm just going to focus more on the social media. I'll be gathering some stories. We're running my Campus Corner column, but I'm going to focus on some of these stuff outside of the actual broadcasting. You're a teacher. How do you get away with saying, yeah, this semester, I don't really think I'm going to teach?
What time are your office hours?
Sixth Tuesday of the month at 11:30. I'm there for an hour. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Mary Emma Graham says, what we're doing at colleges and universities is helping people change and transform into the best people they can be. Our job is to create a space where that's done as safely, openly, and honestly as possible. So when you start using the word concealed, it's the opposite of that. CB okay with open carry? No. No, you would not be okay with open carry, Professor. Let's just get that right out of the way. Professor Resilient says she's considering adjusting or not offering her office hours. She said, I wouldn't be comfortable having a student who's drunk come to my office and bring their alcohol. To me, it's the same thing. Is that happen a lot? Where you got students show up drunk? I can't imagine, but okay. The Daily Kansan quotes a professor saying that the university has failed to show its opposition to the change during the transition. Quote, the university did not stand up against this as a whole. Only faculty and students did, so we didn't have the leadership to make it really clear that they were trying their best for the students. All along, the assumption has been that there's nothing you can do about it, and that is the problem that I have. Professor Resilian says it's disappointing that some people don't think campus carry is a big deal. She said a lot of people aren't thinking about their position and privilege. Unfortunately, she said, I don't have that luxury not to think about my position as a woman, as a person of color. I'm an immigrant, she said. Too many people aren't thinking about all of the different aspects of this. Well, again, and maybe I'm not. I'll be the first to admit, maybe I'm not. But to me, this isn't a huge sweeping change. The law in Kansas, in the state of Kansas, not just on college campuses, but the law in the state of Kansas, is that if you can legally possess that firearm, you can legally carry that firearm. That's been the law. Now, you can get a concealed carry license in the state of Kansas. They still have concealed carry licenses, and many Kansans do. And many Kansans will continue to do so. But all this does is extend state law onto campus. That's all that this does. This doesn't create a new set of laws dealing with concealed carry when you're on a college campus. It simply extends the existing state law onto that campus space. So, again, if you've got the issue with campus carry, do you have the broader issue with concealed carry? And if you have the broader issue with concealed carry, I guess there are a couple of states left in the country where you can still go. Maybe you can go to coastal California. But throughout most of the United States, you're going to be living in a place where your neighbor, your coworker, the people around you in traffic very well may be concealed carry holders, because there are millions of us, and the numbers are growing by the day. All right, stick around. When we come back, Cheryl Atkison joins us, host of Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. Brand new book, The Smear, is out today, and we're going to talk Fast and Furious as well, so stick around. We'll be right back with more Cam and Company coming up right after this. Talking with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Ledee from the Armor for Troops Foundation. What is Armor for Troops all about? I mean, it sounds like it might be kind of self-explanatory, right?
We started this in 2005. We realized there was a lot of shortage of equipment overseas, so we started the foundation. We provide anti-ballistic eyewear, Under Armour, multifunction tools, knee pads, elbow pads, antibacterial clothing. You know, you don't, Marines and all military in the war zone don't shower for 2 or 3 weeks. At that point, only your mother will love you. But we provide equipment. We're doing boots, boot pads. We started doing some vests, but they got so expensive we couldn't do it anymore.
Wow, that's still an amazing amount of material that you all are able to supply free of charge to these members of the military.
The boxes we were standing in had a retail of $750 of all the stuff we put in it. In addition to all the equipment, we also put in batteries, toothpaste, toothbrush, disposable shavers, deodorant, clear eyes, lip thing. We had face wipes, hand wipes, foot powder. So we put a big box together.
That is fantastic. And this is all volunteer driven?
Yes, it is. We have zero salaries. Everybody is a volunteer, have been for over 10 years, and no one gets paid anything here.
And how many people have you been able to help since 2005?
Well, we sent out over 46,000 pairs of eyewear alone. So you got to say we've helped over 46,000 people. Doesn't count the thousands of Under Armour and multifunction tools, etc.
That is incredible. Was there anything like this when you were active duty?
No. And I did 31 years in the Marine Corps. So because of what was happening, especially going to a war zone, I remember what Secretary Rumsfeld said. You go to war with what you have, not with what you want. So we started figuring out that there was a shortage of things. We were going to do something that no one else has done. The military did offer equipment. We just gave them better, great equipment.
I emigrated from Venezuela, one of the most dangerous countries in the world today. A few years ago, the government came for our guns. We were told we would be safer without them. Of course, the politicians, the rich and famous, their bodyguards and criminals, they still have their guns. Everyone else lives in fear. Mothers and fathers are powerless to defend their families. But the drug cartels and gangs, the colectivos, still have all the guns they want, and 90% of murders are never solved. The biggest mistake Venezuela's made was believing that this could never happen. Today, they would do anything for the Second Amendment freedom that we enjoy as Americans. Never, ever take it for granted. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
There are places only the hunter knows. Places where there is nowhere else. Where if you think of nothing, perhaps you will feel the ceaseless past begin to stir beneath your feet. And a chorus of voices whisper something you could never explain how you know. What it felt like the moment the mammoth appeared. The utter stillness of the battle. And the primal celebration that followed the kill. But maybe you don't need to explain it. Maybe it explains you. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back. Thanks again for being a part of this edition of Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Coming up an hour from now, Guy Relford, Second Amendment attorney in Indiana, talking about the aftermath of the Peruta case and the decision by the Supreme Court not to take that case. But right now, I want to welcome to the program host of Full Measure with Cheryl Atkison. Brand new book out today called The Smear. We're going to talk about that, how shady political operatives and fake news control what you see, what you think, and how you vote. Cheryl Atkison is with us. Cheryl, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And congratulations on the new book, The Smear, How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote. And I want to ask you, because you and I have talked about Operation Fast and Furious on several occasions before, and I think that you were kind of the subject of a smear campaign when you started reporting on Operation Fast and Furious.
Well, yes, pretty much the last couple of years, as these groups that manipulate news and narratives became more sophisticated and organized and influential, pretty much any story I did that stepped on the toes of the powerful, whether it was corporate interests or political interests, generated this sort of organized smear effort. And I think a lot of reporters have met with the same thing. And it's been somewhat successful in squelching stories and, you know, serving certain narratives.
You talk about the ubiquitousness of the smear, right? I mean, is it your opinion that almost every story that that we're paying attention to has its smear artists and its spin doctors?
Yes, I mean, in many respects, if you listen to the people who operate in this universe, who I interviewed in the book, that's what they say. Their own words are. One of them said, "Nothing happens by accident." That virtually every image you cross on social media, in the news, the other images you see in daily life are the result of carefully chosen narratives and imagery that well-organized forces are putting before you. One of them said something like, everything happens for a reason. Nothing is by accident. And once you start to look at the common narratives you see across many news organizations and social media, with a common language being used, it starts to make sense. We're actually a very diverse nation. The news shouldn't look exactly, well, as much alike as it does, with the same terms, the same lead stories, the same main stories making the headlines every night when there's so much to report on, except that I think a lot of strings are being pulled.
You know, and getting back to Fast and Furious, I mean, we sort of saw that. You were the one who broke this story in the broadcast media. You're doing interviews with whistleblowers like John Dodson. And you're actually advancing the storyline about what the hell happened here, what's going on, where the rest of the media, I think, was very much, particularly the Washington Post, getting their comments from sources at the Department of Justice and the Justice Department telling them under no circumstances were these guns allowed to go across the border unsupervised. They're getting a story. They're getting a spin. The media is picking up on the Washington Post article and the tone there. And so this all of a sudden became, oh, it's a Republican witch hunt. They're just going after the Obama administration. And if you dare to report anything different, well, that puts you outside of the tribe of journalists, right? And all of a sudden you're sort of out there isolated and alone.
Agreed. And that was the point. That was an organized process. There are emails that show this. Some of them are in the book. Government emails that show how they were trying to turn the press attention away, and they were largely successful. And I'll tell you something that I haven't reported, because it's just sort of behind-the-scenes stuff. This was a story that initially Democrats were interested in backing. I received calls from Democrat staffers and committee staffers and members of Congress after I reported the first stories. And they were, instead of just both sides, Democrats and Republicans, going after an interesting story. We didn't know where it would lead. We didn't know at the time this was something that people in the White House knew about, certainly. Mm-hmm. Instead of following it, they were literally trying to calculate how it would play with their gun rights constituents. And even the Democrats were confused as to whether taking on this story would be good for them or bad for them. They were like, oh, I just don't know if this is a gun control issue, a non-gun control issue, how my people will feel. And I remember saying to one Senate, very prominent Senate staffer who had discussed this with me, I said, isn't it just sometimes the right thing to do regardless of these things you're considering?
Yeah.
And he said, you'd like to think so. And that was the last I ever heard from it, from a Democrat. And Republicans ended up picking it up. And so, therefore, Democrats who were interested in the story had to make it a Republican narrative, because the order of the day came down that this had to be controversialized and marginalized, because the longer it went on, the more we saw it did go to high levels at the Justice Department and even some people at the White House.
You know, and since the inauguration of Donald Trump, the media has sort of decided that investigative journalism is important again after 8 years where it was just sort of a side project. At fullmeasure.news, you had a piece on Operation Fast and Furious. You went back and talked with John Dodson recently, And there was a quote in your piece by Trey Gowdy. You say that members of both parties say that they still don't think they have all the answers as to what was really behind Fast and Furious. Representative Gowdy said, "I'm struggling to understand how this ever could have turned out any other way. As soon as the gun leaves the parking lot, unless you're maintaining constant surveillance and you've lost the gun. And then if it crosses the border, God knows what you're going to do with it. And then when you learn that they didn't even let our Mexican counterparts in law enforcement know what was going on, this is the most imminently predictable tragedy that I've been connected with since I've been in Congress. It could not have turned out any other way. We still don't understand, Cheryl, how this was supposed to work, given the parameters that they laid out. I mean, how is this supposed to ever be successful? And if it could not have been successful, what was really going on here? If this had happened under a Bush administration, this has happened under a Trump administration, you know this would be front page stories. But I think, sadly, the media just really, as you say, they were not going to cover this story. They had to turn it into a Republican witch hunt if the Democrats weren't going to do their due diligence on this.
And we never did get to the bottom of it. I mean, there was a lot of focus on Fast and Furious, but I uncovered about a dozen other cases that I ran across in my research in which ATF officials or related Department of Justice agents were doing the same thing, letting guns walk. So it begins to look like a broad-based strategy coming from somewhere rather than, you know, just one kind of mistake being done out of Phoenix. And because the president withheld documents under executive privilege, some of which are continue to be withheld today, we don't really know the whole story. You know, there are a lot of connections and potential connections with alleged CIA operations, cross-border things. You know that we have armed enemies in the past when we've picked sides among distasteful characters. We've tried to pick the least distasteful among the fighting factions, and we've armed them in the past. Is that what we were doing here? Were we helping arm the Sinaloa cartel against the Zetas, who we figured were more involved with terrorists and were more dangerous? I don't know, but I do think that there were components of this operation that were never revealed and may never be.
Speaking again with Cheryl Atkinson, maybe one day, Cheryl, the documents, maybe if they're in the Obama library, you know, 25, 30 years from now, they'll be opened up to the public.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is once so much time goes by, in all seriousness, I feel like the chance of getting documents, whether it's for this or unmasking documents about alleged political use of intelligence or whether it's my FBI file, these things, when they're withheld for so long, if they're that potentially damaging, I think they probably just kind of disappear.
You know, I suspect that you're probably right about that. I hate to say it, but I think that you are right about that. And unfortunately, you know, this is what you describe in your book, Smear, is certainly not a perfect world, but it's I think advice and a guide on how to live in this environment that we are in, and how to recognize the spin and the smears when you see it. I want to ask, where do you think who's one of the biggest offenders of the smear in your mind?
Well, I talk about corporate interests and both Republican and Democrat interests. Everybody wants to be good at it. All sides are taking lessons from the other and developing their techniques and using the internet. But Republicans and Democrats alike will point to David Brock, who was a smear artist who used to smear liberals. In fact, he used to smear the Clintons, and he's acknowledged and confessed to that. But then he switched sides, and now he smears conservatives or reporters who report facts that are uncomfortable to the people who support him. And he's developed this, you know, quite formidable empire, I call it, of LLCs, nonprofits, neutral-sounding watchdog organizations, groups that hire and train so-called reporters, pay reporters to write certain things that are then placed in news networks. I mean, all kinds of, you know, organizations. He gets paid millions and millions of dollars through that we've documented through these organizations he's built. And they appear, like any good smear organization, to have a broad reach and represent far more people than, in my view, they actually do, because it's really the same relatively small handful of interests using different names and different organizations that accomplish the same goals to give the AstroTurf appearance that everybody thinks a certain way. And that's the whole goal.
And I will tell you, Cheryl, there's a better than average chance that you're being watched by a David Brock minion right now, because we have our own Media Matters fellows who watch NRA TV each and every day and write about us.
I'm pretty sure I haven't, at least in the past, been assigned. And on the basis of this book, I'm sure I'm being assigned to have everything listened to, and I talk about this in the book, how they operate, how they assign people to listen to syllables and words and sentences and appearances and comb through tweets and to really search for anything that they can to try to controversialize and discredit the best way they can.
Yep, absolutely. Again, you can read more about this in the brand new book out today, The Smear, How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote. Sure, we've only got about a minute left, but let me ask you, and I know you've got a lot of advice for consumers of news in this book, but what's the one thing that, we as consumers of news should keep in mind, and what's the best way that we can fight back against this?
When you see common narratives and phrases being used across the board by so many in social media, on the news, comedy channels, wherever you look, I think you have to at least consider the possibility that a narrative has taken hold that may not be true or may be exaggerated in terms of what people really think. Trust your cognitive dissonance. When you see and hear people say everybody knows X or Y, but you don't know it or you don't think it, trust your instincts and consider the possibility that someone is trying to shape or manipulate what you think for a further goal, and start thinking critically about why that might be and what it is they don't want you to know.
Cheryl Atkinson, the book is The Smear. Also, make sure you catch Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson. What is the best way to for folks to catch Full Measure, Cheryl?
Well, at fullmeasure.news, we have our list of TV stations under About, but you can watch it at fullmeasure.news anytime. It's a Sinclair product, and we post our shows and segments on there. So, hey, anytime for free, check
awesome.
It out.
Hey, Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck with the new book, and hope we get a chance to do this again soon.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Cheryl Atkinson joining us from Full Measure, the book The Smear, out today. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins is going to join us on the program in just a little bit. Top of the hour, today's hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy. Plus, next hour, Guy Relford, Second Amendment attorney, and our friend Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum. So stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up next.
Speaking with Travis Rupert with Hunts for Healing Incorporated, what is Hunts for Healing?
Hi, John. Thanks. What Hunts for Healing is a completely voluntary 501(c)-based organization that is aimed at getting combat wounded veterans, physically, emotionally, and mentally injured vets that are post 9/11. We get them, we bring them up to our facility up in Lacyville, Pennsylvania, which is located in Susquehanna County. And we bring them up completely, take care of all of their food, amenities, staying, and they basically just have to show up. And we basically get them back out into the outdoors, you know, outdoors and hunting, fishing, any type of activity associated with the outdoors is shown through evidence-based practice to really help vets get over physical and mental and emotional disabilities that they come back home with.
How did this all come about?
Hunts for Healing was started back in 1994 by a lady of the name of Mindy Picotti. She was fortunate enough to come across a very big parcel of land, and herself being a vet, had an epiphany one day cleaning her house about what she could do with all this land. And it literally, she calls it an answer from God, but it allowed her at that point in time to basically have this vision and put together this organization to bring vets in. And that's how it pretty much all got started, just by some old lady cleaning her house.
That's crazy. You have these different places, Travis, where you do your best thinking. Probably thought about it and got a message from the man upstairs, and off you went.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's one of the things that we're different than most other veteran organizations. Is if you look at our logo, it says emotional, spiritual, and physical. So we do a lot of our things. We do have a God-based belief, and we don't force it on anyone. But that's kind of the thread, I believe, that keeps Hunts for Healing together. You know, that it really keeps it all and brings it all as far as the spiritual and the emotional type healing. That really tends to help a lot of guys, even if they're not religious. You know, when they come to us, a lot of them say, "Hey, you know what? I decided to start going to church, and it's really helping me."
That's cool. Speaking of Travis Rupert with Hunts for Healing Incorporated. So, Travis, why do you do this? Why is this important to you?
I do this. Hunts for Healing, believe it or not, actually, I tell everybody I speak to, Hunts for Healing saved my life. I myself was in the position that a lot of our vets are in. They come back. They know they have a problem. They know they're broken or they have emotional or, you know, physical issues, and they don't know how to deal with it. Until I hooked up with Mindy and Hunts for Healing, I was at a very, very bad place. So seeing what they did for me and how they turned my life around, I feel it's my duty and my obligation to give back, not only to just the organization that saved my life, but to also every other veteran, brother, sister that's coming back that may need the help. That's why I do it. And I can speak pretty much for everybody involved with Hunts for Healing. They all have the same motivation for doing what we do.
Give me a typical example, Travis, of a story that's, or a vet that's really touched you.
I would have to actually go with a gentleman. We'll call him George for the sake of speaking. George came to us. It was actually my second event as a mentor after I'd gone through the program. And he came and he was very, I don't know how to really to explain it, but he needed to be there. He really needed to be there. He had a lot of trouble dealing with his emotional problems, had problems like with home, you know, being home, and just really felt like he was lost. I mean, and I got to spend 5 straight days with him in a turkey, you know, hunting turkeys and stuff, and just seeing the transformation from this broken little, you know, 18-year-old, 19-year-old, what I thought was a kid, coming back from the war, you know, completely lost, and then only after spending 5 days with us, he basically is almost like my own poster child. I see myself when I look at him, because I was there and I can completely relate, empathize, and sympathize with these guys. But George is the guy that I'll always remember no matter what, just because there was nothing really special in, you know, but it was just the time spent together and the healing that occurred with inside him, and seeing that on, you know, day 5 when he left, that right there is something I'll never forget.
All right, quickly, how will we get more information about Hunts for Healing?
The best bet to do is get on the web, www.huntsforhealing.org. Again, we're 501(c), so every penny we make makes it right back to the veterans. Nobody takes a salary and a paycheck, so that is the best way to get a hold of Mindy to find out more information to see what Hunts for Healing is all about.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. We've got our hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy, coming up top of the hour. But right now, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins from Breitbart News on Twitter, at A.W.R. Hawkins, is with us. A.W., how are you, sir?
Super, how are you?
I am good. That would be Dr. A.W., by the way. My apologies. So let's get the big news out of the way here. We've been talking a lot the past couple of days about the Peruta case, the fact that the Supreme Court decided not to hear this case yesterday. I'm curious your thoughts and your take on the decision, and then the dissent that we saw written by Justice Thomas, joined by Neil Gorsuch.
Well, of course, I would have rather them reviewed it. But the dissent gives me some degree of confidence moving forward. I'm puzzled by Alito, and I'm puzzled by Roberts not joining on. You know, they only needed 4 justices to hear this. I'm puzzled by that, but I am also encouraged by Thomas's dissent, joined by Gorsuch, that, you know, this is an opportunity. You know, Thomas wanted the opportunity to say, hey, there is a right to carry. Hey, you know, you can't pick some rights, and those rights are valid outside the home, but other rights only valid within the home. And that's all a paraphrase, but those were his arguments. You know, he said it's improbable that the founders meant you have a right to carry a gun only from your bedroom to your kitchen. And I think going forward, we're going to be able to see, it seems to me under President Trump, a court that turns more toward the Thomas Gorsuch position than away from it. And particularly if he's a two-term president, where he is going to get at least one more pick on that court and maybe 2. So I was encouraged by it, and I mean that wholeheartedly. I would have rather him reviewed it, but the dissent to me was encouraging.
Yeah, I'm with you. And, you know, honestly, I would rather the court pass on this case. If we've got 5 justices who can look at the Second Amendment and tell me, no, you don't have the right to bear arms outside of the home, then I'm glad the court skipped this case. That we talked with Chuck Michelle earlier today. There were other challenges
And hopefully the makeup of the court will change favorably over the next couple of years with some retirements from some well-deserved jurists who maybe time to step off the bench and maybe get some fresh ideas in there. But I think that you're right, Dr. Hawkins, about the hope provided by this dissent. I mean, Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch laid it out. Since 2010, they've heard the Supreme Court's heard 35 First Amendment cases. They've heard 24 cases dealing with the Fourth Amendment. They've not heard a single Second Amendment case. And we've got some pretty loud voices on the court saying, listen, we've got to keep talking about this because this right is now being treated like a second class right.
You know, it's something, I don't know how long you want to spend on this, and I don't want to drag it out, but I do want to point out, to your point, what Justice Thomas pointed out is, look, one of the last cases that the Supreme Court heard on this, of course, McDonald v. Chicago was the last one, but prior to that, in 08, was Heller, and Thomas pointed out that, hey, the Ninth Circuit's decision runs completely opposite of Heller. Mm-hmm. That it runs in contradiction to Heller. So it's clear that there needs to be a decision set forth. There needs to be a ruling set forth. That's Thomas's position. And I'm like you know what? At the right time, let's set that ruling forth. And if this would have gone the wrong way, I think we're in a much better position now that they didn't review it, that we know going forward we get the right construct in there and then we hear the case. We'll be far better off than if we had have heard it in the last week or whenever it is that they would have heard it.
And you're right. Now, there were a couple of things that we heard specifically from Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch yesterday. Justice Thomas talking about how improbable it would be, and you wrote about this at Breitbart, how improbable it would be that the framers thought that the right to bear arms meant you could carry your gun from your bedroom to your kitchen. Dr. Hawkins, I mean, like, that's the thing. I've seen the comments and the quotes from the gun control advocates praising this the court's decision yesterday not to hear this case, but I got to tell you, I have yet to hear a really good argument, whether it's from a gun control advocate, an academic, whoever, as to how it can be that the right of the people to keep and bear arms means that you can have a firearm in your home for self-defense, but you can't carry it around anywhere.
Right. Well, I mean, here's what I've yet to hear them tell me. Is why I have a First Amendment right once I leave my porch, or why I have a Fourth Amendment right once I leave my porch, or why I have a Ninth Amendment or an Eighth Amendment or a Sixth on. See, these are all of a cloth, as you know. And because when the left took over our education system in the counterculture movement, they began to suck out teaching these simple, yet important lessons. And what people have to understand, a God-given right is a God-given right. If you would rather say a natural right is a natural right. And the Constitution, the Bill of Rights hedges in a body of rights that are God-given. They are natural rights. If one of those rights is limited to the home, they're all limited to the home. If one of those rights can be exercised outside the home, that is, it expands further than the home, then all of those rights expand further than the home. So the left eventually is going to have to bite themselves on this. They're reaching around so far to try to make their case. They're going to have to end up biting themselves on this because they're going to have to say every right in the Bill of Rights is limited to the abode and the abode only, or they're going to have to say, you know what, Ninth Circuit's wrong, and you can carry a gun in public for self-defense. And that's obviously what Thomas believes.
Well, and, one of the other stories that you wrote recently talking about the right to carry in schools. And in Colorado, you've got educators who are being they're all concealed carry holders. They've been designated by their school districts as security. And they are getting trained up. This is, I think it's a great story, Dr. Hawkins. I mean, you had a fantastic, successful run of the training last week in Colorado. And this is, again, this is already happening, whether you like it or not, this is happening. What took place last week was the training. But you've got gun control advocates who are complaining about these gun owners and these concealed carry holders, these educators, getting an education.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's crazy. You remember that used to be the argument, Cam.
Yeah.
You remember back in the day when this all started, we're not against law-abiding citizens having guns. We're against people who aren't trained having guns. We're against people who aren't safe having guns. Well, now they're getting training, and what do we find out? They're still against it. And so, you know, the way I think about this, in Colorado especially, there's some rural districts where police response time is 30 minutes. The gunman at Sandy Hook had 9 minutes, a little over. I think he had 9 minutes and 35 seconds. You take Sandy Hook times three. That's how much time we're talking about. Wouldn't matter what kind of gun you have because no one else has one. So it's not, it doesn't boil down to the type of weapon the attacker uses. It boils down to the amount of time you give him with no armed response. And these teachers in Colorado are going preemptive. They're not going to give him that time. They're not going to wait 30 minutes till police respond. They're going to protect the kids immediately. And if you oppose that, then you've got problems and issues I don't even want to begin to deal with. I just don't even want to talk to you if you oppose that.
Listen, I'm with you. And, you know, we had the opportunity to talk with Laura Carno. She described some of the individuals who are doing this. And, you know, I mean, what she said, she put it so bluntly, Dr. Hawkins. She said these are people who are willing to put themselves between a killer and the kids that they're teaching. They're willing to take that bullet. But do we demand that they do it defenseless? Or can they have the opportunity to protect themselves and those kids under their care? You've got these, again, these individuals, they're going to do this regardless. They're going to try to do what they can to save those kids in the classroom. The question is, do we allow them, if they so choose and if the district so choose, to have that firearm? And I'll be honest with you, I know that Ceasefire Colorado may very well try to make this an issue in the state elections next year. I hope they do. I really hope that they try to make the argument that these school districts and the teachers and the parents should not be able to come to this decision on their own, that there are just some things that are just too extreme, and protecting these children with armed security is one of them. I want to hear them make that case.
I do want to hear them make it. You know, when you say this, I think she always has to be mentioned. The principal at Sandy Hook, I think her name was Hawksprung or Hawkspring. Excuse me if I've mispronounced it. I mean her no disrespect. She charged that attacker. She was not armed, Cam. She charged that attacker and sacrificed herself to try to save those children. Who in their right mind, knowing that, would put another teacher or principal in that position? Who in their right mind would not say, you know what, we can fix that scenario. The next brave principal or the next brave math teacher or the next brave biology teacher, when you charge him, you're going to have a revolver in your hand. You're going to have a Glock in your hand. You're going to have a shotgun in the room. I don't know what they have worked out. I'm not trying to give anything away. I'm not trying to act like I know. I'm just saying whatever gun you have, you're not going to charge him empty-handed. That's the only humane way to handle this. Otherwise, you're saying to these teachers, you know what? We like you, but you're just a sitting duck to us. That's not how you treat fellow humans, not in my mind.
No, not at all. All right, last story and an update on something you and I talked about last week. The push after the shooting in Alexandria of Congressman Steve Scalise, lobbyist Matt Mica, and others. There were a couple of lawmakers, Dr. Hawkins, who had talked about, listen, you know, we got to be able to carry concealed. And there was some, I think, confusion as to, you know, what the priority is going to be. Were they going to seek out carve-outs for members of Congress? Barry Loudermilk from Georgia, you say, has clarified his position. Reciprocity for the common man, that is the priority here, National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, there were two or three that, and he said it. He admitted. He said, look, my original comments were hard to understand. They weren't clear. And, of course, he was emotional when he said them.
Sure.
And so, but he's come right out and he says, look, carry for congressman is going to be tucked into H.R. 38, which is carry for the common man. And he made sure he said carry for the common man is the priority. And so I think it is important. I was quick to criticize him, and I thought he needed criticism, but I'm also quick to say, you know what, he clarified his position, so we need to acknowledge he clarified his position. And so the thing we need to do is rally now. Representative Richard Hudson, and I've emailed with his office some this morning, communicated with his office. We need to get this going. H.R. 38 is a national reciprocity bill that will mean a concealed carry permit in any one state is valid in the other 49. That needs to be the law of the land yesterday. And while we have this slight momentum right now, we need to get moving. And that means the House leadership needs to get moving, but it also means that we need to call our House members. And as I always stress, call respectably, email with respect, write with respect, but repeatedly contact them and say, hey, I'm your constituent. I want national reciprocity now because my rights are Second Amendment rights.
Absolutely. And if your lawmakers are home for the Independence holiday, they're doing events in your district, some face-to-face time and conversation. Great as well. Dr. Hawkins, thank you, as always, sir, for coming on the program. I look forward to doing this again very soon.
Oh, thank you, Cam. God bless you, bud.
You too, sir. AWR Hawkins from Breitbart News. You can find him again on Twitter at AWR Hawkins. Saturday, there was an event in Madison, Virginia, that I really wanted to go to. My Congressman Tom Garrett was going to be there. They were dedicating a plaque. Yes, I'm the type of history dork that will go drive an hour and a half for a dedication of a plaque. This was a plaque for a Medal of Honor recipient, a Buffalo soldier born in Virginia, who earned the Medal of Honor out west in the late part of the 19th century, and a plaque going up. And I've never actually met my congressman in person. He was elected in November. I thought, oh, this would be a good opportunity. And then we got hung up with some stuff around the house, the honey-do list, and I looked up, and all of a sudden it was going to be too late. So I missed that. But before long, I will hopefully get a chance to meet face-to-face with my member of Congress. In the meantime, you can always email, send those faxes, I suppose. They still read the faxes. Phone calls are good, but make sure that your lawmakers have heard from you. Dr. Hawkins is absolutely right, and we've got over 200 co-sponsors for National Right to Care Reciprocity. So we're getting close to majority support just of co-sponsors in the House. And we need to start moving on this issue. All right. We are going to have to start moving towards a break here momentarily. But coming up next hour, hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum will be with us. And we'll talk more with Guy Relford, Second Amendment attorney in Indiana, about the Peruta case. Plus, we've got more talk about the National Right to Care Reciprocity. Mayors across the country apparently opposed to National Right to Carry Reciprocity. Why is that? Well, we'll fill you in next. So stick around. Hour 3 of Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, coming up right after this.
This is a very unique race here, the Bass Pro NRA 500 here in Bristol. Give you a little feel for Bristol. You go around it in about 15 and a half seconds. And you got 40 cars on a half-mile racetrack. It's really, really tight.
Even though it's a tight racing and rough racing, you got to be patient. You can't tear your car up too early. You got to be able to be around at the end.
Things happen so fast, and that's what makes it just an awesome place to be, because there's action all over the track for the fans to watch and see.
Our fans, you will not find a more patriotic sport than NASCAR. These fans love our freedom, our Second Amendment, our Constitution, our liberty. That's what this country was built on. That's the kind of people that our fans are, our drivers. And it just gives me great honor to be here.
What makes Bristol so special is this is the last great Coliseum. And you can tell by when you first walk in this place, if you look up and you're surrounded by fans, the track is so banked and you're right on top of the action.
I came to Bristol probably in 1969 for the first race. Probably had 10 to 15,000 seats in the grandstand. There's an old guardrail around it. People sat on the grass banks in the back of it. And it was asphalt. And today, the track holds 160,000 people.
It's the Glass Great Coliseum, I guess you would want to call it. It builds so much energy for the fans. It builds so much energy for the drivers and pit crews. So it has something very special about it. That's why they say it's Bristol, baby.
Things just happen quicker here. You know you got to stay in the race to win the race.
It's real tight racing. It's bumper to bumper, and you got to move people and make things happen.
As a driver, I had a lot of fun. Some of my best finishes were here. You know, Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon are grandsons, and they both race in NASCAR. As a car owner, I've had cars to finish 1, 2, 3, won the race, finish second, third. And we've also, as a car owner, loaded 3 of them on the rollback and took them home. So it can go either way. It's feast or famine at Bristol. Now I look back and think how it was on my daughter and my wife when I was driving. So I guess I'm getting payback, whatever you say.
I had to put myself in a good position, and it sucks for Ty. He had such a good run going, and the moves he was making were really impressive. And we just kind of let the race come to us. We had a good car all night, a third and fourth place car. And when it all said and done and everything played out, we were the car to win. So it was a bummer for him, but I'm glad we're in victory lane. Go up that hill, I get to do a burnout on the way up. All the history that's taking place here and to be a part of it is special.
We'll take it any way we can get it. We love these fans here at Bristol. They were cheering loud over there in the front stretch and burning it down. And hopefully we can do something like this come tomorrow night. Love this place, and I want to get as many fans as we can in here.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of Cam and Company. It starts right this second. So glad you're with us here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Fueled as always by Hornady Ammunition on the program this hour. Hero of the day, deal of the day. Our good guy of the day, Guy Relford, Second Amendment attorney, will join us. Also, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum will be with us. We've got a lot of news to get to as well, so let's get right to it. Starting with our hero of the day, brought to you by our friends at Adcor Defense. And boy, what a great story of defense this is from the Washington Times. Sunapee, New Hampshire. An 80-year-old New Hampshire woman fought off a rabid bobcat with the help of her two dogs and her gardening sickle. And her son, who had a shotgun. That was a pretty important part of the story, too. Associated Press did not lead with that, however. Elise Dabrowski says she was gardening Sunday at her home in Sunapee when the animal attacked, biting her face, her arm, her back. She said her only thoughts at the moment were, why is this stupid cat attacking me? I think my thoughts would have been much less coherent than that. My thoughts probably just would have been, But Dabrowski tried to fight off the bobcat with a sickle. It was ultimately chased off by her dogs, comes back, her adult son hears the commotion. He comes outside with a shotgun, kills the bobcat. Bobcat tested positive for rabies, and Elise going to have to get treatment for that. She needed over 50 stitches to close her wounds, but she says she is thankful that it wasn't worse. I am thankful that her son was there with the shotgun, thankful that Elise had her sickle and her dogs and everybody engaged in a team effort to make sure that Elise was going to be okay. Elise's son, today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day from WAFB, Channel 9 in Louisiana, Baker, Louisiana. A man now sits behind bars for allegedly murdering two people, also listed as the victim of a shooting that happened just 2 days before his arrest. Additionally, WAFB says his latest arrest, his fourth over the last decade. William Bottoms Jr., age 27, on Wednesday, June 21st, was shot in the chest. There's Mr. Bottoms. Looks like he's still wearing his hospital gown. I like the devil horn tattoo on the forehead, Cameron. I never thought about doing that as a bald guy. I should have done that, maybe.
Go big or go home.
Covered up with a hat whenever I wanted.
Make it all the way around, like curly, really go for it.
Oh,
yeah, you know? Like ram horns.
Ram horn, right.
Like the L.A. Rams helmet.
Right. Just do the L.A. Rams helmet again. Yeah. You don't want to paint it on Sundays.
Bottoms was taken to a local hospital with life-threatening injuries on Wednesday. Friday, he's released, and he's taken to the East Baton Rouge Parish Prison, charged with two counts of first-degree murder. He's being held without bond because he had been released on parole just a few months prior. Now, we're laughing at this guy's unfortunate facial tattoos, but this is a serious story. WAFB says Bottoms has been in and out of prison his entire adult life. He's 27. At 17, he was arrested by the Baton Rouge Police Department for armed robbery and aggravated battery. Guess what happened? Guess what happened? Just days before his 18th birthday, Bottoms took a plea deal. The armed robbery charge disappeared, went away, and he was he pleaded guilty to second-degree battery. So armed robbery gone, aggravated battery gone, second-degree battery is what he pled to. Judge sentenced William Bottoms Jr. to 5 years in prison, then suspended that sentence and placed him on probation. Okay, that was 10 years ago. November 18th, 2007, Bottoms broke the terms of his probation when he was arrested by the Baker Police Department for armed robbery. That's right. After only a few months of freedom, Bottoms back behind bars. He pleaded guilty a second time, and he was given a reduced sentence. March 2009, he's sentenced to 6 years in prison. Now, WAFB says he served out his full sentence, according to the Louisiana Department of Corrections, and was released on full-term parole on November 18th of 2013. Help me do the math here. March of 2009, he gets sentenced to 6 years in prison. November of 2013, he serves out his full sentence and he's released. I guess, again, time off for good behavior behind bars. So the six-year sentence is not a six-year sentence. The six-year sentence is closer to a four-and-a-half-year sentence. This is for his second armed robbery charge. That was 4 years ago. Just after a year after he got released, Mr. Bottoms, facing new criminal charges from the East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office, charged on October 11th, 2014, with attempted armed robbery, aggravated assault with a firearm, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and three different drug charges. Judge Louis Daniel accepted Bottoms' plea deal yet again, third violent crime, third plea deal, May 2nd, 2016. That's when this plea deal was accepted. That is almost a year and a half after he was first charged, and just a little more than a year ago. And Mr. Bottoms got 7 years in prison a little more than a year ago. WAFB says during his third stay in prison, Bottoms took part in early release programs that gave him credit to allow for early release. Because of this, he was released on March 31st, 2017 on good time parole. Holy cow. He got sentenced to 7 years. He did a month? He did a year? That is unbelievable. Williams Bottom Jr., less than 4 months after his release, shot in the chest. Deputies with the East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office connected him to the murders of Muhammad Hussein and Dedrick William, whose bodies were found on June 1st of this year in a vehicle abandoned in a field. William Bottoms Jr., who has not been able to spend more than a year in freedom without committing more violent crimes and keeps getting plea bargains, keeps getting released early, now charged with murder. So the good news is the lax sentences have probably come to an end for Mr. Bottoms, but it took the death of two people for us to get to that point. William Bottoms Jr., today's deal of the day. Our good guy today from WFMY, Channel 2, CBS affiliate. Actually, the story's from KHOU in Houston, Texas, so we'll just go with the local story. Caden Wilson getting ready to turn 7 not long ago. Told his mom he didn't want to party. She asked why. He said he didn't have any friends. So what's the point of having a party if you don't have any friends? Stacy Wilson, Caden's mom, says, I actually walked off. I started crying. I didn't want him to see me cry because I was upset that he said that to me. It broke my heart. Break any parent's heart. So Stacy Wilson reached out to Officer Tommy Norman, who's a police officer in Little Rock, Arkansas. He's got a considerable following on Facebook. And Jessica Lynn, who manages the Facebook page, said somebody wrote into us about wanting cards sent to their little boy who apparently didn't have any friends. They didn't ask for anything else but cards to be sent. Post said, so this adorable little one lives in Houston, Texas. He's 6 years old. He has a birthday coming up. Says he can't have a birthday party because he has no friends. Says no one likes him. Doesn't think anyone would come to a party if he had one. Officer Tommy Norman said, I'm speaking to the Harris County Sheriff's Office right now to see if a deputy can go say hey on his birthday. And would anybody else be interested in sending him a birthday card? Post got shared about 500 times on Facebook. It was pretty good. Facebook event page got created to help organize a party. All of a sudden, you got strangers who are RSVPing. They're offering to bring desserts and cover the cost of the party. They decided to throw Caden a party at the Urban Air Trampoline Park. Actually had to limit the number of attendees to 200 before it got out of hand. Here's a kid who didn't think anybody was going to show up. Officer Norman ended up sending out a special birthday message to Caden. And Caden's mom says, my gosh, my heart is so warmed. I get the chills. It's just awesome. He feels loved, and so do I. It feels awesome. I just want to tell everyone thank you so much. So Officer Norman there in Little Rock, Arkansas, helping out a little kid in Houston, Texas. And again, the hundreds of members of the community there in Houston, Texas, Harris County, from the sheriff's office on down, for helping make Caden's birthday the best one yet. Thank you for being some of the many, many good guys out there. Now, staying in Texas as far as news stories go, interesting story from the Dallas Morning News just reported how they say they unintentionally misled people about guns. This is, I think this is actually pretty fascinating, because rarely do you see the media focus on their mistakes, right? Now, I know CNN has let go three reporters recently for the single-sourced story that apparently was completely bogus. But you don't often find the media going back and looking at what they've done. But Mike Wilson, who's an editor at the Dallas Morning News, said a subscriber from Plano, Texas, emailed him to say that he had read something in the June 21st Dallas Morning News that couldn't possibly be true. It was an eight-paragraph study, or an eight-paragraph Washington Post article, ran on page 10A of the Dallas Morning News, reported on a national study about kids and guns. This was the pediatrics study that was released. We talked about this with Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. The last sentence of that eight-paragraph article from the Washington Post said that 4.2% of American kids have witnessed a shooting in the past year. And Dowd said, does it really sound believable that one kid out of every 24 has witnessed a shooting in the last year? He said, I don't think so, unless it was on TV, in a movie, or a video game. In that case, it's probably closer to 100%. Well, Mike Wilson, editor at the Dallas Morning News, says Dowd's instincts were right. The statistic was not. He said, here is the unfortunate story of how a couple of teams of researchers and a whole bunch of news organizations unintentionally but thoroughly misinformed the public. Wilson says it started in 2015 when University of New Hampshire sociology professor David Finkelhor and two colleagues published a study called The Prevalence of Childhood Exposure to Violence, Crime, and Abuse. They got their data by conducting phone interviews with parents and kids around the country. And the study included a table showing the percentage of kids, quote, witnessing or having indirect exposure to different kinds of violence in the past year. The figure under exposure to shooting was 4%. Wilson says those words, exposure to shooting, are going to become a problem in just a minute. He said earlier this year, researchers from the CDC and the University of Texas published a nationwide study on gun violence in pediatrics. They reported that on average, 7,100 children under the age of 18 were shot each year from 2012 to 2014, and that about 1,300 a year died. Wilson says no one has questioned those stats. The researchers also quoted the exposure to shooting statistic from the Fingalore study, changing the wording, and he says for some reason the stat just slightly, saying recent evidence from the National Survey of Children's Exposure to Violence indicates that 4.2% of children aged 0 to 17 in the United States have witnessed a shooting in the past year. He says the Washington Post wrote a story about it. Dallas Morning News picked up a version of the Washington Post story. Wilson says, when I got it, I asked editorial writer Michael Lindenberger to do some research. He contacted the author of the original study who explained the origin of the 4% quote exposure to shooting stat. According to Fingalore, the actual question researchers asked was, at any time in your child's life, was your child in any place in real life where he could see or hear people being shot, bombs going off, or street riots? So as Wilson says about this was a much more open-ended question than simply shooting. And this gets, again, twisted and taken out of context. And cited in the Washington Post, and therefore a lie goes halfway around the world before the truth can put its boots on. Wilson says all of this matters because scientific studies and the way journalists report on them can affect public opinion and ultimately public policy. The idea that 1 in 25 kids witnessed a shooting in the past year was reported around the world, and some of the world probably believed it. Mike Wilson says no matter where you stand on guns or any other issue, we ought to be making decisions based on good information. Yes, that is true. Unfortunately, the unintentional mistakes are often coupled with intentional misleading information from journalists and editors who have an agenda, particularly when it comes to issues like gun ownership. And it would be nice if the editor of the Dallas Morning News would recognize that that happens too. All right, we're going to step away for just a moment or two. When we come back, Guy Relford, Second Amendment attorney in Indiana, joins us. Julie Gunlock later in the hour, so stick around. Still a lot more Cam and Company straight ahead.
Talking with Ron Sasaki from AmericanSnipers.org. In case people haven't ever heard of AmericanSnipers.org, what is the mission of this group?
Okay, what our mission is we help equip our military snipers. If they have any equipment needs when they're getting deployed, if they can't get equipment through their normal chain of command, they get a hold of us, and we gift that gear to them. No cost to them. We operate solely on donations. We're 100% nonprofit, all-volunteer organization. So we're just trying to help these guys out as they're going downrange.
And this is really, I think, a brotherhood that got started here. I mean, you've got a law enforcement, military members who were instrumental, I mean, in putting this together. This started with one guy helping one guy, and it kind of snowballed from there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it started, most of us have a law enforcement background. We're all current or former SWAT snipers. So in the early 2000s, we had some of our brother snipers getting deployed in various units, and they found out there was an equipment shortage at that time. So they asked for some gear, and it got donated, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. So we've been going strong ever since. Kind of slowed down with the units getting deployed over the last few years, but of course things are starting to ramp back up again.
Absolutely. And you talk about the slowdown, but it never really disappears because, you know, a lot of these guys are kind of operating in the shadows. They're not operating in the theaters where we see a lot of headlines about combat. Some of these missions are taking place in places where we don't necessarily even think about guys being on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And because it hasn't been on the headlines, people kind of forget about them. And then, you know, so their budgets shrink, too. So we are still supporting some of those guys, even some of the, you know, the bigger units that are doing a lot of work overseas. So we've got a lot of equipment that's been going out. So, you know, all the donations and being able to be here at the NRA show has been great. That really helps out a lot.
That's fantastic. And just give me an example of like some of the type of equipment that you will provide these guys. What are they not getting?
Well, it's mostly sniper-specific equipment that we provide. So it's a lot of binoculars, range finders, spotting scopes, the Kestrel wind meters, a lot of those things that the guys ask for that they have a tough time getting through their normal chain of command. We operate solely on donations. So if you can go to americansnipers.org, you can donate there, or you can buy some of our T-shirts and hats and challenge coins, and that's what helps us out.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage. The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
This land. This is life's stadium. And the people who enter must know it is not a place for media hype or cheering fans. The spotlights of sun and moon and stars will never showcase human arrogance. In fact, the only contest that is celebrated here is the Earth's determination to sustain life. Join this celebration. Arrive with a purpose. Compete on the world's most challenging fields. Winning and losing won't mean as much as just being. You will be among the most courageous and competitive athletes on the planet, and in awe of its rules. Trust the hunter in your blood.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Coming up a little bit later on in the hour, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum going to be with us on the program right now. Very pleased to have with us on Twitter at Guy Relford. You can find him online at relfordlaw.com. Guy Relford, Second Amendment attorney in Indiana, with us on the program. Guy, how are you today?
Doing great, Cam. It's great to be back with you again.
It's good talking with you. I was talking with our mutual friend Tony Katz earlier today on WIBC about the Peruta decision. And, you know, I said I'm obviously disappointed that the Supreme Court didn't hear this case, but at the same time, I guess I'm a little relieved, Guy, that if the votes aren't there right now, I'm glad that we didn't have four justices who are opposed to our right to keep and bear arms agree to hear this case and then try to cram through some awful decision that says, no, the right to keep and bear arms is really just the right to keep them.
No, I absolutely agree. And, you know, we could have potentially taken a situation that right now, while it's a very significant problem in a few select counties in California, and I don't minimize the impact on the poor people that have to live under that rule of law in those counties in California, had we not had the votes to have the right and proper outcome in the Supreme Court, we could have turned that into all of our problem. Now, I think there's also, though, been overreaction to the decision. I've had people here in Indiana, people from either other states within the Ninth District out in the Western U.S. who have said, oh, my goodness, you know, are my rights now going to be restricted sort of automatically as a result of this decision? And so I think a lot of what I've been doing over the last 24 hours is trying to get people to take a deep breath and understand what the impact of the Supreme Court not taking the case really is and what it really is not.
Yeah, well, and the impact, frankly, for Indianans is going to be minimal because you're not in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And even in the Ninth Circuit, this doesn't establish any new laws. This simply says that the status quo is going to remain in effect for the foreseeable future.
And really, you're exactly right. And it's really even more limited than what I think most people realize, because of the nine states that are within the Ninth Circuit, three of them, Idaho, Nevada and Alaska, or excuse me, Idaho, Arizona, and Alaska actually already have constitutional carry, where no license or permit is required to carry a handgun outside the home. So they've moved well past, you know, any restrictive policy or regulation like we have applied in some of these select counties in California, where not only do they have to establish a good reason to carry a handgun, but the sheriffs there are implementing that in a way that basically means no one gets a handgun. So, you know, in a full third of the states in the Ninth Circuit, they don't need any reason because they don't even need a license or a permit. And then really, when you look at the restrictive practices in place, you've got California, you've got Hawaii. And those are, you know, those are the states where the Supreme Court now, by not taking the case, has said, yes, you can keep your restrictive licensing practices in place. The battle is going to be purely at the state level on whether any additional states within the Ninth Circuit or anywhere else want to implement those same kind of restrictive regulations.
And that would be a battle, Guy, I mean, because as you well know, the movement when it comes to the right to carry has been entirely in one direction. We have not had a single state in the union go from shall issue to may issue, or even go from constitutional carry to, well, all right, we're going to have a shall issue. We have seen state after state move from these restrictive policies to actually recognizing the right to carry. And I think it is only a matter of time, frankly, before Hawaii and California and on the East Coast, you know, Maryland, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., New York City. I think it's only a matter of time before either the courts or the people convince these states to actually recognize our right to keep and bear arms.
Well, and I think the courts are going to do exactly that, Cam. You know, the Flanagan case is pending right now out in California, and that was the follow-on to the Peruta case. You know, the Ninth Circuit in that en banc decision really did something I think that was intellectually dishonest. And what they did is they ignored the claims in the plaintiff's complaint specifically that said, you know what, because California bans open carry for all intents and purposes, and because the sheriffs in these counties, including San Diego County, are so incredibly restrictive on who they issue a license to, that essentially the people in those counties have no right to bear arms at all. And that's a combination of an open carry ban with these restrictive practices on issuing concealed carry licenses. And so it's that total regulatory structure that was at issue in the Peruta case. And the three-judge panel recognized that. And certainly Justice Thomas's dissent, joined in by Justice Gorsuch today, recognized that. But the en banc decision was completely disingenuous, and they said, well, we're only addressing the constitutionality of these practices that go to the concealed carry of firearms. And yes, there's some historical support for the idea, even that the founders understood that, you know, bad guys conceal their firearms, and so we need to be able to regulate that. But we're not reaching the issue of whether open carry is somehow protected or not under the Second Amendment. And that ignored the basic and inherent claims the plaintiffs had in the case, which it was the entire regulatory structure that resulted in a violation of their constitutional right to bear arms outside the home. And I think they had to really spin the case in such a way to reach the result that they did as an outcome-driven analysis. And I'm surprised and disappointed that the Supreme Court didn't call that at least four justices, which is all it requires for certiorari to be granted. I'm really surprised that at least four justices didn't want to call him out on that. But I still think it's going to happen. We've got other cases, whether it's Flanagan or the Grace case, it combined with the Wren case, another good cause requirement that the District of Columbia has imposed. But, you know, there are two different preliminary injunctions have been granted against the enforcement of those requirements in D.C., and that's teed up as well. So I think it's on the horizon. I think we'll see a Supreme Court case, and I think it'll go the right way when that happens.
I hope and suspect that you are right, Guy. And, you know, just getting back to the egregious way the en banc panel in the Ninth Circuit treated this case, because they got called out by Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch yesterday in that written dissent. And I don't know if that's embarrassing for those justices, but the Supreme Court justices who wanted to hear this case certainly went on the record and said that the Ninth Circuit completely misrepresented what this case was about. I mean, you go back to the trial court, the very first judge to hear this case, told the plaintiffs, look, your rights aren't being violated because you can openly carry an unloaded firearm for self-defense. Because at the time, California law allowed that, right? And so that was the argument from the trial judge. She recognized you've got a right to carry outside of the home, but your right is not being violated because you can still do so openly with an unloaded handgun, but whatever. Now, I don't accept that as a standard of self-defense, but that's what the trial court judge recognized. That three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit that originally decided the case, as you said, at that point, the California legislature had passed a law banning the open carry of unloaded firearms. And so the Ninth Circuit panel said, well, you know, you could have carried, but now you can't. So it's not a matter of your rights being regulated. It's a matter of your rights being infringed. And then out of whole cloth, that en banc a panel of the Ninth Circuit decided that the issue wasn't the right to carry. It was the right to carry a concealed handgun in public. Nobody had asked that question. Nobody thought that was the question at issue. But I think, Guy, this was a dodge by the Ninth Circuit. I don't think they can come up with a great legal rationale as to how the right to keep and bear arms can encompass the right to have a firearm in your home for self-defense, but that right doesn't extend outside your front door. And I think the best move for that Ninth Circuit, the anti-gun judges on that Ninth Circuit, was to do exactly what they did, to try to divert, disassemble, and then say, you know what, if you want us to answer that broader question, go ahead and file another lawsuit. We'll see you in a few years.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly right. And that's what the Flanagan case is. The Flanagan case is that next lawsuit in California. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to have a harder time dodging that again. Now, again, I think it'll be another outcome driven result. I'd be surprised if the Ninth Circuit did anything other than spin that in some way to allow them to reach the same conclusion. But boy, I would think that would be awfully hard for the Supreme Court not to take, since now, I mean, we've got a really basic argument, which is, you know what? These people in these counties have no right to possess a firearm for self-defense outside the home. None. They can't open carry. They can't conceal carry because they can't have a license. How does that not infringe the Second Amendment? And that, man, if that doesn't go right to the meat of the issue, and if that doesn't compel the Supreme Court to want to take that case, then I'm not sure what would.
In the meantime, Guy, do you think things like the passage of constitutional carry laws around the country, the continued push for shall issue in those places that have may issue systems in place, does that play an impact? I mean, it seems to me like, you know, we talk about what the framers thought, but it seems to me that in 2017, there's plenty of evidence that the right to keep and bear arms is still very much seen as an inherent right by tens of millions of Americans who are currently exercising that right. So whether you believe in a living constitution or not, the evidence to me seems pretty clear that the right to keep and bear arms is exactly that.
Well, I think that's right. But when you get into the analysis that the courts go through, I think the point you raise, which is a great one, I think where it fits into the analysis is that whether you're talking about strict scrutiny or an intermediate scrutiny analysis, the state has to show that they're at least tailoring the regulation to meet some legitimate end that the state should have, some legitimate state purpose. And whether that's the most narrowly tailored under strict scrutiny or some legitimate connection under intermediate scrutiny, you apply either one. And what do they always say? Well, we're trying to protect the public. We're trying to, you know, minimize the mayhem. And when you have state after state after state that goes to constitutional carry, where we're doing away with licenses or permit or the requirements of a license or permit, not doing away with the licensing structure for reciprocity and other reasons, but where you do away with the requirement of one, so you have more and more people carrying with no license or no permit because they're not prohibited possessors and they can lawfully do that, and the incidence of violent crime in those jurisdictions goes down afterward, which we've seen now in several states after the institution of permitless carry or constitutional carry. How do you take that and those statistics and those facts with a decline in crime when we do away with a license and then spin that into how states are somehow advancing a legitimate state interest in being incredibly restrictive on who they even issue licenses to? That those don't go together. And that's why I think that movement toward permitless carry or constitutional carry, and the continued reduction in violent crime that that causes when more and more law-abiding citizens are able to defend themselves lawfully, that starts arguing strongly on our side of the equation.
Again, Guy Relford joining us, Second Amendment attorney in Indiana, on Twitter, at Guy Relford. Guy, we are unfortunately almost out of time, but do appreciate your analysis and your insight and the fight far from over at the Supreme Court when it comes to our Second Amendment rights.
Oh, yeah, much more to come. And thanks so much for the opportunity to come back on with you, Cam.
Always good talking with you, sir. Guy Relford with us here on Cam and Company. Still to come, Julie Gundlach will join us. A couple of other news items to get to briefly before we have to take a time out. I mentioned earlier mayors opposed to national right to carry reciprocity. Politico had the story yesterday afternoon. U.S. Conference of Mayors has come out in opposition to the National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act, a resolution offered by New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Yeah, neither one of those mayors real fans of the right to carry. Gun control groups, Politico says, strongly opposed to the measure. John Feinblatt, president of Everytown for Gun Safety, which supposedly has no problem with concealed carry, derided the National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act as, quote, the gun lobby's dream. He wrote, under concealed carry reciprocity, Congress would gut local public safety laws and turn the state's the weakest state's laws effectively into nationwide laws, forcing states to allow domestic abusers, people with violent histories, and people who lack even the most basic gun safety training to carry concealed guns in public. Uh-huh. U.S. Conference of Mayors adopted a broad resolution at its annual meeting stating that, quote, the goals of this legislation are completely antithetical to all of the efforts to reduce and prevent gun violence. Well, of course they are, because all of the efforts to reduce and prevent gun violence are aimed squarely at legal, law-abiding gun owners, right? And that's exactly what the National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act would deal with, the legal, lawful carriers of this country. Uh-huh. And I suppose that would mean it would be antithetical to all of the efforts to reduce and prevent gun violence, like California's magazine ban scheduled to go into effect on July the 1st, or the one-gun-a-month law that California is pushing through right now. Already got it for handguns. It's going to be for long guns. Or for the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, or the New York Safe Act, or Connecticut's gun control proposals, or Colorado's gun control proposals passed a few years ago. All of them, again, aimed at legal gun owners. The resolution from the U.S. Conference of Mayors also stressed that the proposed legislation would, quote, essentially force the localities to give full faith and credit to permits that are issued on less rigorous grounds, remove local government's ability to maintain sensible gun standards, and keep a proper vetting process in place. You know, again, most of the country shall issue laws. Most of the country. But over 40 states, more than a dozen states are constitutional carry. You're dealing with a handful of states, and in some cases, you're not even dealing with the entire state when it comes to these restrictive carry laws, right? Coastal California, not necessarily inland California. And there are some exceptions even to coastal California when it comes to the issuing of concealed carry licenses. Washington, D.C., New York City. You've got some states, state of Hawaii, state of Maryland, state of New Jersey. But for the most part, you're not dealing with a broad swath of the country where the right to carry doesn't exist or exists only on paper. You're dealing with a few places. Now, these mayors don't object to a Texan with a Texas driver's license taking their car from Texas into Chicago, or driving it to Los Angeles. I think they want to charge them a fee to get into Manhattan if they drive their car from Texas into Manhattan. But they do still allow that driver, right? I don't get pulled over when I'm in Washington, D.C. because I've got my Virginia plates and my Virginia driver's license, and D.C. doesn't recognize my Virginia driver's license, even though the laws of the 50 states vary when it comes to what you have to do to get your driver's license. That's not an issue for these mayors. But when it comes to your constitutional right to keep and bear arms, all of a sudden these mayors, again, led by de Blasio and Rahm Emanuel, want to do everything they can to ensure that your right is not treated as a right. I've got bad news for the mayors. It's a right. It's the right to keep, and it's the right to bear. And your objections put you on the wrong side of history. You want to get right with the Second Amendment. You got to embrace the Second Amendment. You can't quit fighting to keep these rights away from your constituents. And that's exactly what's happening in New York City. It's exactly what's happening in Chicago, Washington, D.C., L.A., San Francisco. And it is sad. And it is sad that these mayors have their supporters. Because at the end of the day, what they are doing is trying to put as many barriers as possible between a constitutional right and the people who live in their cities and the Americans who might try to visit. All right, when we come back, Julie Gundlach's going to join us from the Independent Women's Forum. We have a nanny state update, so stick around. Much more Cam and Company on the way right after this quick timeout.
Here at SHOT Show with Kellyanne Pigeon of Armed and Feminine. So, obviously, there's so much to talk about with women and guns and women's shooting. Where are we right now? We're talking about 2017. We're talking about being at a show with so much representation of women, so many women here. This is such a burgeoning industry in general, but for women, it's huge right now.
Loving it, loving it. We still see male-dominated, especially here. I was coming over and I said, now I know what the salmon feel like, you know, swimming upstream. And that's sort of what the women's movement has been like until recently. You know, we've been the salmon swimming upstream, but we've really begun to be embraced by a lot of the manufacturers now, and it had been a struggle for a long time, and we're just a soaring force, and we have so many wonderful ladies organizations right now that are promoting that. And what's even nicer is that, like I said, the manufacturers are responding to us just in terms of holsters that fit us, guns that are lighter weight, things that just better fit our bodies, education for women, which is really, really big from a lot of the organizations that I deal with, a lot of education and empowerment for women. So we're on the move, and we're here to stay, and it's a wonderful thing.
Well, you say you're here to stay, but, you know, let's be honest. We know that women drive shopping decisions. We know that women drive household decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Women, they pick where you're going to go on vacation, you know.
Pretty much.
So you guys, you control a lot of the spending dollars.
And the checkbooks.
So it's where you go, everything else goes, correct?
Yeah. And actually, last year, I think I said to John, too, you know, what the mom and the matriarch and the family believe, so will her children. And so the more women that we get involved in believing this, her children will just, you know, through osmosis growing up, are going to learn that and respect all of that and continue all of this. And so when we say women will save the Second Amendment, that's why, not just the checkbook, but what mama believes the rest of the family will do too.
All right, so you talked about the manufacturers, and of course you're here and meeting with everybody.
Right.
Some of the women we talk to in this industry, they complain about the shrink it and pink it factor, where all they do is make it smaller for your hands, and they they slap pink on it. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I love pink.
Controversy.
I love pink, but all of my guns are black or the sand color. I own no pink guns. I would have to agree. There were some fellas here that I met with last year, and I loved their holsters. Their concept was fantastic. And I said to him, look, you need to move this clip a little bit because we have different pants, hip bones. And so he actually got from the third floor to the second floor, first floor this year. And I said, hey, did you move it? And no, he didn't. So I'm like, did you forget about me? So he's actually making one specifically for me with some ideas that I gave him, and my other girlfriend was with me too, and we're like, this is what we have. He's like, all right, I'm going to make that now. But right, shrink it and
pink it.
Shrink it and pink it is not necessarily where we are.
Right.
When we look at women, we have so many different body types, heights, widths, you know, curves. They almost need a whole specific line, you know, to do that. So step by step, we're getting there. I have found a lot more product out on the floors this SHOT Show rather than last that is a lot more tailored to our needs and really enjoying it.
Yeah.
Really enjoying
When you talk about getting women involved, you know, they come to you first, say, hey, what do I do? What's, you know, elevator speech, how should women get involved in the shooting sports?
Find a trainer.
Yeah.
Find a trainer. I train women from, 18 years old. I think my oldest has been 80. I actually did one class where 10 women, the youngest one was 64 years old, to 80. Yeah, and it was one of the most fun classes that we ever had. They want to learn. They want to do it correctly. They want to be safe. Mm-hmm. The first thing they want to do is be safe. And we always going to say, don't go to Uncle Buck up camp to teach you. Find somebody who is trained, find a trainer, and learn it, because we need to touch things. Like, what is this called? What does it do? How does it work? Where are the directions? And Uncle Buck doesn't always teach those kinds of things. Right. And safety is always on the minds and the forefront of women. So certainly find a trainer. A lot of the organizations have them right online, even when we go to NRA.org, and we can find a class, and you can look specifically if you want a woman. Mm-hmm. A lot of women, what I've learned, feel better or more comfortable, less intimidated with female instructors, mm-hmm. because they feel like they're not going to get shut down or look stupid.
I'm not going to
look stupid.
It's the gym effect.
Exactly.
It's the same thing there.
Exactly.
The women-only gyms.
Right. And actually, I'm starting into my third season, and I only did it very, very part-time the first season. I doubled the number of women that I trained the second season, and I'm going to double that again this year. I just, can't even keep up, which is a wonderful thing because we're starting that. Well, it's a grassroots movement. Do this all locally, and we find that they just can't get enough of it, and they want more training, and they want to do everything correctly. I actually have two students who are going to NRA instructor training this coming weekend.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Julie Gunlock is with us from the Independent Women's Forum on Twitter at JGunlock. And I'm a little, Julie, how are you today? It's good to see you.
It's good to see you. I'm doing well.
I don't quite know how to start this interview because I'm looking at your latest column for Acculturated. And you've got just a ton of links, like what not to say to a mom, what not to say to a mom who had a C-section, what not to say to a mom of boys, what not to say to a mom of girls, what not to say to moms of twins, what not to say to moms with one child, what not to say to moms with a lot of kids, what not to say to a stay-at-home mom. I officially don't know what to say to you.
Better be careful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a minefield.
Yeah. So I've started to see more and more of these articles out there warning people, it's like the campus oversensitivity on things, sort of campus speech codes gone into the mommy mm-hmm. blogosphere. And so you have a lot of these articles where I see, and to be honest with you, I've seen this come out of some of my friends who are writers as well, who have sort of written these pieces like, you shouldn't say this to, a mom of big families or a mom, I wrote the list, okay, and I put links because I'm not making this stuff up. I'm seeing this. And, and when you read these articles, it's always the same. Like, how dare they? One example, women who breastfeed, okay? It can be awkward to breastfeed. And when you breastfeed, you have to sometimes breastfeed in public. And, I've done my share of that. And I've gotten disapproving looks from people. And you just have to deal with it. Because, I think there's this idea that, moms can do no wrong and moms can, they should just be revered for every decision they make. And so that's just not going to happen. People are going to judge you. That's part of life, right? And it doesn't matter if it's parenting or, if you choose to take your kids or, shooting. Hunting, people are going to judge you. And I think it's easier to develop a tougher skin rather than just railing against the reality that judging people is as normal as breathing. We are just never going to change that. And so, I've also kind of been frustrated with the dual narrative of women are so, or moms. You always see this. Moms are super women. They're so tough. They're so great. They can do anything. But at the same time, and often it's the same writers who say this, oh, moms are so tough. But at the same time, moms are obviously so sensitive that you have to watch what you say around them. So I feel like, you can't have it both ways.
And I'm looking specifically at the what not to say to a mom of twins, because we have twins at my place. And I got to tell you, Julie, the author of this piece says, one thing I've learned pretty quickly since having my twins is that you kind of become an instant celebrity. People love twins. I pretty much resign myself to the fact that we'll get attention anywhere we go. And I'm totally cool with that, she says, until people get weird. Well, no, it is true, particularly when the twins are babies and you've got the double stroller and you're pushing them around. Yeah, you're going to get comments. We would get comments all the time. Are they identical? Do they look identical? No, then they're not identical. By the way, one's a boy, one's a girl. Kind of hard to have identical twins.
My husband is a twin. My husband is a twin, and he gets the same question, and he has a sister. But anyway, go on.
Right, exactly. So you know, never, though, did I hear this question and be like, oh, don't talk to me. I can't believe you didn't ask such a stupid question.
No.
And I'm looking here. This author went to, like, some mothers of multiple groups on Facebook and asked, so what have you heard from people?
And she got
right?
the
Because
answers.
A lot of what this is clickbait.
Yes.
Right? This is just, yeah, right. Well. And so here are some of here are some of the questions. At the grocery store, some lady told me I was greedy for having two at once. In the inappropriate, like, do you think that was serious? Do you really think some lady just gave me you greedy two baby mom? Most offensive question I got asked was, are they drug induced? I took it in stride, says Lisa, but later wished I would have called her out for it. You know what? We got those questions too.
Yeah.
By the way, the answer is no. We were lucky. that we wanted one and we got two. We were lucky. But what does it hurt to have that question asked of you? And what does it hurt to answer?
Well,
I don't know, Julie. I don't get it.
There is a real, there's just a victimhood that's come with, and I don't know, it's a strange, sort of, I want to be a victim, and yet I'm such a superwoman for being a mom. And again, I find the disconnect kind of frustrating. I do think that people have trouble. You know, I think people have trouble remembering that. I think moms have trouble remembering that people forget what it is like to have small children or having. Okay, my mom doesn't really remember what it's like to have. You know, I have elementary aged kids now, right? And she doesn't always remember kind of the struggle. I actually don't really remember fully the struggle of having newborns. Okay, so I might say something insensitive to someone about, you know, or joke around with them, and maybe, you know, they're so exhausted they may not have a sense of humor. But the point is that I think people forget, and they may not mean to come off as judgmental or rude or snarky, but they do. And look, we do live in times where people have more opinions, particularly about nutrition, what you're feeding your child. There's a lot more there. I'm not unsympathetic. You know, I also write about how moms need to take it down a notch. But on the judgment, but I think, you know, it's this sort of, this series of articles I'm seeing where moms, you know, can't be told certain things or can't get the stink eye from someone. I just think it's easier to, like I said, to develop a tougher skin, a thicker skin, because you will never, you know, some old guy who doesn't want to see your boobs, you know, out, look, I get that. Like, I understand that. And, you know, I feel like it's a pretty common thing for, you know, an older generation person not really being comfortable with public breastfeeding. And yet, you know, you have sit-ins and like, you know, women who go crazy if they're made to feel uncomfortable for breastfeeding in public. So, you know, I think moms need to calm down a little bit about sort of the judgments they perceive. And I think a lot of it is perception. They may think that they're getting a bad vibe and they're not. So I don't know. It just seems to me easier, if we just calm down a little bit.
I have said, on a couple occasions before, I think we are generation butthurt. I mean, like, we are just the generation
right.
that just,
right.
man, if we can be upset about something that somebody says, we're gonna be.
Yeah.
Chitchatmom.com, 5 things never to say to a large family. You sure have your hands full, don't you? Don't say that.
I mean, that's, you know. That's meant to be nice. Gosh, you're awesome. Good job. Like, oh, it's just always taken. That's the other thing. It's such a good point, Cam. It's like, even when someone is trying to say something nice, you take it wrong. You take it like as an offense. And that's the other thing that needs to change. Just have a sunnier outlook on life. Don't always take offense to things.
Honestly, this was one of the things that this mom, this was the last thing that you shouldn't say to a large family. When are you guys going to have another one? Your kids are just so sweet. You should never tell a parent, your kids are so sweet. You'd be great at having another baby.
You know,
apparently that now, right? How
right.
dare you?
You know, I get now. I'm the mom of.
That's my business when we're going to have more children.
I'm the mom of 3 boys. So, of course, I get a lot. Well, first of all, I get the. And I love it. I revel when women go, oh my gosh, three boys, you must, you know, and I love it when I hear that because it's true. I'm overwhelmed. And two, I also get this one, which I always imagine how unpolitically correct this is when someone says, gosh, you must want a girl. Now, you know, I don't feel that way, but it's well-meaning, you know, and I always respond, oh goodness, you know, I'd have to buy all new things. My husband, thank goodness, you know, I'd be out spending, you know, my children's inheritance. There's no inheritance, but you know, I always make jokes about that, about how I would lose control. I'd buy everything in the little girl's department. And that's the thing. That is, I think, a much better way to approach these things than sort of gasping and being horrified and then running back to your computer to write a blog about how offended you are. It's exhausting, I think, it must be exhausting. And also, I think it sends a message to other moms on these very popular mom blogs that you too should find defense, with the well-meaning things that people say.
I think that you're right, which only leads to more butthurt and more clickbait articles and, right. You know. It's a vicious cycle, and you're right. Just let some of it go and have a conversation. Just answer somebody's question.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's the other thing, Julie. It's really driving me crazy. The constant whiplash of we need to be kinder to each other. Shut up. Don't say anything to me. I mean, like, just, you know, can you just be consistent just for a little bit, right? Let's be nicer to one another, or just let's decide we're not going to talk to each other.
Or it's Game of Thrones, okay? Let's just go full Game of Thrones, okay? It's either be nice or cut someone's head off. Because, I mean, it's just, you're right. I can't deal with the inconsistency, which is, yes, bothering me as well.
Yes. She drinks and she knows things. She's Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum.
I got that stitched
on
a pillow.
Game of Thrones reference?
I do know that.
How many more days until the new season?
Okay, now there I'm beat. I don't know exactly, but I know it's soon. I know it's like a 10?
Okay.
How many?
It's close. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I'm like, listen, I don't, I totally honest with you. I don't watch Game of Thrones. My wife does.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
She would be the one. I know.
You need to bring the wife up. You need to bring the wife up to the new Game of Thrones bar that's in Washington.
That might actually get her to Washington, D.C.
I'll send her the details.
To watch Game of Thrones there. All right, you do that. We'll be talking. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum, thank you for joining us on the program. Thanks for not taking offense at anything I said today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Julie Gunlock with us here on Cam and Company. We are, unfortunately, almost out of time here on this edition of Cam and Company. But tomorrow, Hump Day edition, we're talking with Jen Jakes of Bearing Arms about the asinine comments from Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn. Also, Chad Dukes from 106.7 The Fan of Washington, D.C. on perhaps the best wrestling heel ever. Ever. We'll see you live, 2 p.m. Eastern, NRA-TV, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific on SiriusXM Patriot 125. Until then, be safe. Have fun.